Blog Talk Radio.
You're now rocking to a headshot production. rock into a headshot production.
Live within your means. People that don't manage their money wisely are not managing our lives wisely.
Stories is the senior pastor at First Baptist Church of Lincoln Gardens in central New Jersey, and he's on a crusade. He thinks black America has a new enemy.
Is debt a bigger problem than racism?
Yes, debt is a bigger problem than racism.
You didn't even hesitate.
There's no question to me that debt is a bigger problem than racism.
It's a provocative theory, but Soares stands by his claim.
One out of five of us has no bank account. We still do payday loans. We still do rent to own. But you see, we'll drive shiny cars and we'll wear designer clothes. And we have all of the appearances of doing well, but we won't admit that we're broke. Being in debt is slavery. When I'm paying last month's bills with next month's check, that's slavery. When I'm writing a check hoping that it doesn't bounce, or when I pull out my credit card praying that it's not rejected, that I'm living in financial bondage.
It's a problem exacerbated in today's economy, the worst since the Depression. Longtime church members Doug and Mary Jeffries feel like they're living in financial bondage. They've refinanced their home twice and are now on the verge of foreclosure. They've turned to their pastor for help.
One day, I just broke down. We were at a funeral at the church, and then Soares in his inimitable style pulls up and, you know, "What's up, man? How you doing?" And I said, "Pastor, I ain't doing so well today." He said, "Well, what's going on?" And that's when I just, you know, had to tell him what the deal was.
Douglas kind of convinced me that he was going to ask anyway, and I said, "Well, okay," but I was reluctant.
Was it embarrassing?
Oh, yeah, quite.
Why help Doug and Mary Jeffries? Super nice people. In a way, they make enough money they could just move to another place.
You can't assume that a person who's middle income and has problems is less impacted by their problems than a person who's lower income that has problems.
Greetings. Welcome to Thor Radio Network, Thor Radio Ministry, a.k.a. The Trendsetters, a.k.a. Bring the Truth to Your Debt Issues. Today is Tuesday, September the 16th, 2014. This is your host and founder, Brother Sharif. And we are here live in Thor Studio. As always, first I have to give all honors and praises to the Most High, the Creator, for allowing me to do everything it is that I do, those being successes and failures, trials, tribulations, ups, downs, and even turnarounds. With my Creator, I am able to do anything that I set my mind to do, and without Him, I am able to accomplish absolutely nothing. Hopefully that holds true for you as well. From Thor Radio, we'd like to thank you for congregating with us for another Tuesday debt show. I want to first give a shout out to my chat, all the guests that I have, Mr. Plani, Zaya, Seven, Welcome 11, Seven, what do you know about that, a 7-11, those numbers on you, in your name there? I think you need to look those up. Got a guest 311 as well. A lot of 11s in the house. I'm going to thank everybody for being here. I'm going to get to the lines and open up for my guests. Not my guests. My team. Behind every good man is a good woman or women. I'm blessed to have three of them. And by far, they're three out of best that I have an honor and pleasure to work with them, and sometimes work for them. But when we come together here, we work for you and along with you. All right, we got a lesson here today. Today is also Thor Trivia. Great opportunity for you to get involved with the show content. Thor Trivia is where we read a couple of Dunning letters from our lovely debt collectors who are attempting to collect the debt. And we use this show to afford you the opportunity to demonstrate your knowledge, because it is you that will be receiving those letters. And we don't like to be like other people and hope that you have to wait for us to appear again before you are able to get an answer to your questions. We are all about self-sufficiency, self-empowerment, self-motivation. Which is why we present you with all the information, the informational sources, where you can retrieve the balance of the information in case we don't complete it. We don't hide anything from you here at Thor. We don't want you dependent on us. Today I'm doing something different. I'm going to allow one of our students, listeners and supporters to join the panel today. He's a young man who has dedicated himself to this education, and not just here, but he is a habitual listener of Thor Radio, and he's acquired some of the knowledge that's been proffered here, and he's enjoyed it. So, of course, I do very little bragging, and I'm only as good as you out there. So I like to gauge our progress on how people are transitioning into this information. I'm going to bring Sam on the panel today, and we're going to play a little bit of debt football, whereby I'm going to throw some questions at him, and let's see what he knows. I believe he's in a couple of fights with some debt collectors who are having an early Halloween masquerading as creditors. We'll have Sam on today. See a lot of the students from the webinar this weekend is here. Maybe they've had some time to play with those hammers that was given out. We're here for them as well. Maynard is in the house. A couple of others. All right, let me get to my panel for the... They start telling me why am I so delayed. And I'm going to be quiet for a minute. I'm going to let them do their duties. And then you will hear back from me as soon as time allows. Rudy, Layla, Lori, floor is yours.
Good morning, and happy Thor Tuesday. Welcome, Sam. We look forward to engaging with you today. The word of today is purpose. Purpose, the reason for which something is done. Purpose, why something is created. Purpose is why something exists. Purpose can be pointed, intentional, or purpose can be an overall objective. Thor has made a commitment to you to know the debt world inside out. Now your purpose, your commitment, your drive should be your commitment to your own success for debt knowledge. It's my belief that with correct information, you can attain your desired goals. Here at Thor, the emphasis is the focus on consumer education and empowerment through the Consumer Protection Law. With that in mind, Thor has a very specific purpose, mission, and goal. And Thor is driven for a purposeful success, and that success is your success. Happy Thor Day.
Hello, everybody. Howdy, 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 howdy. I hope everybody had a great weekend. We had a very learned weekend on Saturday. Saturday, for those of you who were able to attend the webinar, I not only want to thank you, but I want to congratulate you in taking ownership of your education and knowledge and taking ownership of your finances. Putting everything in the correct perspective and learning how to set things up in a offensive strategy instead of a defensive strategy, because those of you who are out there who like football always know the best offense is usually the one who wins the game, the ones who have it. On our back-to-school series that I've been doing with you guys, there was something that Brother Sharif pointed out on Saturday, and it's just has been coming back to my mind over and over again. It was just one sentence that he stated, and although it's short, it's so very important, and it's so very impactful, and it really encompasses everything that he's tried to convey with everyone at the foundation level. But his statement was, contract is law, and law is contract. And I know that may sound really mundane and simple. However, really, all the consumer protection laws are simple, and they just make everything seem convoluted. It's all a hologram, as I always say. So if you can maybe take that one sentence and apply it to your when you read over your original mortgage contracts, your original consumer contracts that you've maybe done with, you know, your credit card people or whoever, whatever, your furniture, I don't know, anything you go out there and do on credit. Read your contracts and then once again reflect back on that one simple sentence that he spoke about that just really puts it in perspective. Contract is law and law is contract. And then whenever you look at your FDCPA guidelines, reflect back on that one sentence and then apply it. You can apply it to all of it. However, when you go to 1692E, in which we're always talking about E because E is where you can, I mean, you can just throw all that stuff on a violation. To letters, calls, you name it, it's out there. They always fall into the E. But on E, a debt collector may not use any false, deceptive, or misleading representation or means in connection with the collection of any debt without limiting the general application and foregoing of the following conduct is a violation of the section. I just jacked that whole sentence up. However, y'all know what I'm talking about. But I want to dial it down to that, and then if you'll read 1, 2, and 3, I won't go over it, but if you'll read 1, 2, and 3, and then just go back once again, look over your contracts, and then contract is law, law is contract. Who can take legal means against you? So anyway, that's what I want to say to start everything off. And I hope everybody's enjoying this fall weather. Here in Texas, it's been hot as hell. So now it is absolutely gorgeous. The fall weather has set in, and man, I'm a coffee drinker, and I do love reading and drinking coffee in the morning in the fall weather. So, anyway, that's all out of me for now. And congratulations, Sam. Glad to have you with us.
Good morning, Source family. I don't know if I heard the disclosure, Brother Cerise. Correct me if I'm wrong, or Rudy or Lori, but I'm going to go ahead and state it now just so that we can enjoy the rest of our broadcast. Thor's disclaimer is as such. The information discussed on this show is not and will not be considered legal advice. There are no attorneys, bar members, or any other private legal groups associated with this broadcast. Please be informed to thoroughly research the information provided prior to taking any action. And, you know, with regard to what Rudy said concerning purpose and what Lori talked about this weekend in Thor University, if you have not attended any of the university classes that Thor has provided, you are missing out on the key pivotal nuance, the key pivotal tactics that you need when you're going to be engaging with any kind of a debt collector. I will say to you guys that I have took some time to go sit in just a JP court just to see how things are going on there, because a lot of our cases on the onset will be conducted in the JP court. And I just wanted to say that Thor provides the ammunition that we need to overcome any kind of a fear or any kind of confusion that we have when it comes to dealing with any kind of a debt collector situation, be it our credit cards, be it the mortgage transactions that we engaged in, be it an auto loan, any kind of a debt situation, that's what Thor is helping you to overcome. I would just say that, you know, projecting fear and creating confusion are the tools of the enemy. whoever you consider that enemy to be. Do not give into the fear. When there is confusion, just maybe step back and observe. Because if you'll find that if you do step back, you'll see who's stirring the pot, who's becoming that mischief maker. So stand up using your own mind to decipher what's truly going on. Take action in your cause with confidence that your cause will be delivered to your benefit. This weekend, I can tell you that Brother Sharif took out that sword mallet, and he had to crack that mallet on some of our heads to be able to grasp what it was that he was talking about. And, you know, it really, really became ingrained because it was just a different concept. And as we go through this educational process, please remember that you have to separate yourself from the past training that you had. You know, I come out of 25 years of the mortgage industry, the very industry that we're talking about going up, I'm going to say going up against, but we're really not going up against the industry. We're going up against a system that has perpetuated itself in a certain way. But I'm just saying that I've been trained a certain way, and I still have to get a lot of things out of my head. I have to detox, and I just recommend that everyone take that purposeful action to detox your brain. Come out of her, my people, is the cry. Come out of that old way of thinking so that you have the ability to learn something new and fresh. Just start all over from scratch. Even if you've been doing this with Thor, just take some of the old knowledge that you have and just say, you know what, I'm going to forget about it. I know it will creep up, but just aim to dump it, trash dump it as much as you can. Take it like a hard drive, and you can just erase a hard drive. Aim to erase it out of your mind so that you can grasp the concept of Thor. Because I can tell you this weekend, I mean, I was so grateful that Brother Shoot talked to me afterwards because it cemented better, and I understand it. So just for the basics, for those of you who are new on the call, just remember that you're an A3. You're dealing with an A5 from somebody who is purporting themselves to be an A4, but really they're an A6. All right? With that being said, welcome, Sam. We welcome to hear what you have to say and interact with us, and we look forward to our wonderful broadcast.
All right. Well, that's how women throw down. Y'all heard them Thorines getting it in. Coming out that Bible, the book of the FDCPA, they were throwing out those A's. I love it. Sam, why don't you introduce yourself, man, to the population, your people, your congregation, your community. Tell them a little bit about yourself, go right ahead.
Okay, first I want to thank you and the panel. And thank you to all the young ladies that welcomed me. And Brother Sharif, I'm stunned you asked me. I appreciate you for doing that. For the callers that are on the phone, I need to make sure that they understand that I've never met Brother Sharif personally. And the things and or accolades that I talk about for Thor is real. Simply because I've researched it. I spent the last 2 years fumbling around, and I use the word fumbling around, trying to get the facts on how to help others and also defend myself against debt collectors. And there's a lot of bad information that's out there. And when I said 2 years, I'm meaning six and a half days, because I would do seven, but you just can't. Your brain won't take it. So 6.5 days of studying any and everything that I can find on the Internet and print and just reading. Now, the fumbling part is there's bad information out there. You spend a lot of time researching bad information. And I always teach my two boys, always tell the truth, because if you tell a lie and you're trying to find the truth, someone's chasing a lie looking for the truth. So Brother Sharif speaks factual truth that can be researched in several different places. And I'm not an educational type of a guy, but I've learned that if you can find three or four resources and the information comes back to that one point, then it's factual. And basically that's it. I've gone and had my home taken from me by speaking to an attorney here in Chicago that told me, well, there's nothing you could do. This was 5 years ago. And I just walked away from my house, a home that I dreamed about, had built, worked hard for, and was unable to maintain. So because of that, that's the reason that I'm here today. And that's my background.
All right. Well, we appreciate that, Sam. And again, sometimes, as coming up, being taught, being a student, being a form of teacher, you should be always called upon to bless the stage with your presence and be able to articulate your learning. And I love what Layla and I love the word of the day by Mother Rudy, and I love what Lori said. And one of the things we do have to make sure of is that we definitely remove ourselves from those antiquated thoughts and mindset that we have. And I find that's the biggest challenge, is that when you listen to Sam and you listen to others fumble around, so to speak, and we've all fumbled around, and I did too. And then I just took it upon myself to go and find the information from a reliable source, which was the law, and spend my own time studying and obtaining the information that I needed. I found it funny that when I first started studying years ago, it's something different when someone tells you and then when you come across the information yourself and you digest it and you internalize it, that it feels like you discovered it. And I would regurgitate some of the information that I was able to obtain. And some attorneys and some paralegals and people that knew a little bit more about it would always look at me as if they were like, okay, yeah, you didn't know that? Okay? And I would say, no. And probably if you told me, I still wouldn't understand it. All right? My point is this. I think Thor does a good job at breaking things down to a lower vibrational level to where you can get it. I think we add some levity to it. I think sometimes we're serious about it. I try to hit different gears to hit different ears. But at the end of the day, you have to go and you have to digest it for yourself. And when speaking about the hammer webinar that we did this weekend, a hammer has weight to it. It's not a paper hammer. It's a hammer. A hammer is designed to separate materials or an object in pieces. So it's something that when put into your hand, you have to get used to it. You have to practice with it. You might have to read it a few times. Everybody that was in attendance at the webinar this weekend, you have an absolute hammer. Was it easy? No, nothing's easy about this. You know, easy for you to go down and buy a sandwich. But no, it's not easy for you to sue anybody. It's not easy for you to engage in law, which, as Lori said, something you do every day. So when someone tells you about law, you are the law more times daily than you would ever believe. you are entering into contracts all the time. And every day, you are a consumer within those contracts every day. Right? So like she said and repeated that I've said, contract is law and law is contract. You can enter into as many contracts as you like. You can enter into any type of contracts that you like, as long as you and the other party agree. If there's any disagreement with that contract, you have the opportunity to go to any competent court and seek redress. And if there are issues within that contract that is adverse to state or federal law or both, then a court has the authority to adjudicate those issues. I want you to think about what I've just said. Now, I want to talk about a few things today. I want to talk first about the emails that I sent out, just to let you know how much of a consumer you are and how important it is for you to know the consumer protection laws. First, the call-in number is 657-383-0332 for those of you that may have questions, comments, or concerns. And I sent a couple of email out. One was an article regarding Comcast, who some of you may be a consumer of. And Comcast allegedly was bullying customers that were using a VPN, which is a virtual private network. What it does is, and I'm not very good on analytics, but it allows you to use a different internet server to do your web surfing and things of that nature. VPNs has been out a long time. A lot of corporations use them, things of that nature. They're for privacy, okay? Many times, if you don't know, a lot of you have wireless, and if you don't have a secured wireless access point, then anybody outside can jump on your network and see what it is you're doing and what your password is, your bank accounts are, and, you know, things of that nature. So it's a privacy mechanism. And many people use it. If they're not comfortable or secure in their internet connection, or they're in a place, you know, they use a VPN, okay? Now, VPNs and those type of companies are very legal, okay? They operate no differently than Gmail and Yahoo and any other internet provider. But Comcast was telling customers that was using the VPN named Tor, similar to ours, but T-O-R. And what happens is when you're using those VPNs, I guess you are not using their internet. And depending on what kind of plan you are, maybe, I'm assuming that they're not getting enough of your usage. Or it may not be that. It may be they're trying to assert authority where they have very little, which is also a common problem in our country. So what Comcast was telling some customers were, you can't use Tor because we're not able to monitor your internet activity, just in case the government was to subpoena us for your internet activity. And whoever's on the email list, y'all read that article, and it was absolutely just ridiculous that we have a utility company who works for the people who you pay for service, telling you that you can't use another company who very much would be a competitor, you can't use their service because that service is illegal, or, you know, usually people, criminals hang out over there, okay? Criminals hang out over there, and they're trying to hide their activity. And you can't use it just in case the government wants to see what you're doing. We need to be able to tell them. All right? Now, I don't know if many of you caught what I just said, but what business is it of Comcast to tell you what to do, one, to tell you who to use, two, to speak about a competitor, three, but then most importantly to tell you that it's their job to spy on you just in case the government wants to. That was the damning part of that article that I found reprehensible. Who are you, or even the government, to tell me or anyone else what to do? Because you have a couple of wires in the ground and offer a service in a country that belongs to the people. Okay? You putting a couple of wires in the ground does not make you a ruler or king. I absolutely could not believe what I was reading. But it shows that until we as the people and the consumers wake up and put an end to this nonsense, we're going to have a lot more of that. Next thing you know, we'll be having people riding around in Burger King police cars asking you if you ate a Whopper today and writing you a ticket for buying a Big Mac. This is absolutely ridiculous. And someone I know, at least a good attorney out there, will see that story and wouldn't mind going to Comcast and making them have to put a few more wires in the ground to make up for compensation to those that were injured for them telling them that. Next, I sent you another article regarding your CFPB, which we're going to talk about today, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. By all means, they are what you may consider the government of the debt collectors. They were created a few years ago by Mr. Obama's administration. And they were created because we know that the debt collection arena is and has been out of control. Although we had the consumer protection laws where you really didn't have anyone but the FTC to kind of monitor the debt collector's behavior. But they were stretched. They couldn't keep up with all of it. And I think it's telling that the creation of the CFPB was at a time where most of these, the mortgage collapse, let's just put it that way. And they knew most of these alleged debts were not owed to creditors, rather debt collectors. And they didn't want to see the country be further abused. And they were being abused when it was just Johnny Ranchers debt collection agencies, Pookie and Ray Ray's debt collection agencies collecting, you know, old telephone bills and water bills and things of that nature. Now we were having private equity groups and hedge funds creating big corporations who were debt collectors. We had law firms that were two men in a truck, basically, now opening up 10-floor buildings foreclosure, but were really debt collectors. So with that being said, that agency was created, and they've been doing a pretty fair job. at least of late, going after these debt collectors, especially these mills, foreclosure mills, operating as debt collectors. And I've always said to you, if you notice, these firms, although you will ask them questions and they will wiggle and, well, no, we're creditors, we're working for the creditor, when you see all of these cases that the CFPB brings against them, they're bringing it against them in the name of what? Not the foreclosure laws, not the creditor laws, not the Supreme Court cases saying who MERS is and who's not, and not any of that. They're bringing these cases under the same authority as we teach here at Thor, which is consumer protection laws, specifically the FDCPA. And the consumer protection, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau law, which they've enacted when they were created. And I don't know if you guys knew, or guys and girls knew, that when they were created, they created a law for themselves, for them to enforce their laws. They implemented some rules. And that was basically, and if you read the article, you would have seen it there, that they have a, what you would consider an Unfair and Deceptive Practices Act under the CFPB. So they can bring complaints under any of the consumer protection laws as well. They can bring the action under their Unfair Deceptive Practices version as well. So they're serious. They go for the big bucks. They also, in many cases, if you look at the case I'm going to speak about here in a minute with the Hannah case in Georgia, they're seeking to acquire compensation for those consumers and homeowners that were affected by these foreclosure mills actions. I always applaud those, but often when everything shakes out, and we'll see here, the homeowner winds up getting very little. So we hope that won't be the case here. But at any rate, it was a good run. I don't know if y'all know some of the politics that was going on. They went after several foreclosure mills in multiple states. It's a huge department. You can file a complaint with them. If you go to Consumer Financial Protection Bureau website, you can file complaints if you experience some harm as a result of a debt collector. I'll be honest with you, they keep very good statistics on the amount of complaints, and I believe that is, it is those numbers that drive them to start investigating some of the debt collectors when they receive a good number of complaints. They get thousands of complaints against one, then they'll start, they'll turn the microscope around and go check them out, which is what they did lately. Now, for those of you who know, the case that I'm talking about is Frederick Hanna, H-A-N-N-A, foreclosure mill in Georgia. That's just one of them. They run a foreclosure mill, allegedly, but again, they were sued under the consumer protection laws. I'm going to say that one more time. So if they were creditors, how would they be held accountable under the consumer protection laws? I'm going to say that again. So I believe I sent an article out to all of you that basically, there were two law firms that combined together, had been responsible for 625,000 foreclosures. That's 625,000 families that were affected by debt collectors celebrating an early Halloween masquerading as creditors. Okay, 625. And we're talking about boogeymen that are in the other side of the world, if they even exist. And we have terrorists right here in our country displacing 625,000 consumers. Picture that. All right, at any rate, they went down and they put some of these debt collectors in their sights, went after them. Okay? And sued them. Well, they tried to take them into state court. And politics got involved to where the state court, Supreme Court, who, by the way, all of these individuals in the Bar Association, so-called license, they give them permission to do what it is they do. They have rules. I believe they have an oath. And one of those oaths has to be to the U.S. Constitution and the Constitution of that state, if it means anything. I don't know how much it means when 625,000 consumers were abused. And that was just two law firms or two foreclosure mills. But nonetheless, the CFPB went into the state court with the action, and Supreme Court stepped in for their society and said, look, nobody chastises our, as mothers say, our churn but us. So CFPB, you don't have the authority to deal with the licensed attorneys that we license. CFPB was like, oh, really? Oh, it's like that. Oh, you going to step in and tell us we can't stand in for the people because you license the individuals that committed harm against the people, and you're going to step in. I don't know if you're stepping up for them or you're stepping in with your own belt wanting to spank them for the egregious violation that they committed. Well, we know that wasn't the case necessarily. Anyway, CFPB took it to their arena, which was the federal court, and said, okay, now let's see what you can do. And that's where the case is. Okay. So I sent everybody the complaint, and we're going to go over a little bit, at least what I put in the email. It was funny, the first three pages of the foreclosure mill's response and motion to dismiss, which was 51 pages, and it was replete with repetitive language. But at any rate, it just really annoyed the heck out of me because within the first three pages, the basis of their motion was...
Layla?
Yes, Brother Sharif, can everyone hear me? Brother Sharif may have dropped off the line. So we'll wait a moment for him to come back and complete what he was saying.
He went on vacation.
So everyone, please stand by for a second.
All right, I'm back.
He's back from vacation. My bad.
Okay.
I'm back. Yeah, I fell out the chair. I'm just kidding. All right. At any rate, they went and the first three pages of their motion to dismiss was basically, we don't come under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And we were practicing law, whatever that is. And the CFPB doesn't have jurisdiction over us. And anything that's a practice of law, we're just allowed to go to our creator, which is the Supreme Court, and they will dole out any punishment of us. You can't touch us, basically. And then they went to an area that I found reprehensible, and they sought cover and protection under the very same Constitution that they took an oath to. And they said under the Third or Fourth Amendment, I forget, they were protected. The first thing came to my mind is the same Constitution that you took an oath to and the same protections that was afforded for thousands of consumers and homeowners that you illegally foreclosed on. What about their constitutional protections? So it was just annoying. But at any rate, that was their position, and I'm sure it will not work, okay? And you should read it and get an understanding. You should read all of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau cases because they will give you a lot of information. They are the pros at translating and demonstrating how powerful, how adequate, how complete, and how non-controversially those consumer statutes are written. There was no ambiguity in them. Okay? And they do a great job at breaking that down. And they are what we call the King Kongs of what they say is what they say. So is that a department that gives you, in case Thor doesn't give it all to you, some confidence? Because we always try to bring you education, and we try to back it up and support it with what is being said by the courts and being said by the CFPB and our translation of it, our opinion of it. And you can take it the way you like or read it for yourself.
Hey, can I make a – before we move on,
can sure
I make
can.
A real quick comment on this? Whenever I was reading, one of the things that stood out to me on that 51-page motion to dismiss that they filed, which was comical at best, I mean, obviously, but one of the things that I noticed while reading it and others, I agree with Brother Sharif, I highly encourage y'all to read that and all their different complaints that CFPB does, but on Hannah's motion to dismiss, they basically laid out in 51 pages how to defend, how to address, how to write, how to accuse, how to lay out everything in a complaint. They all of their reasons why it should have been dismissed, you know, because they didn't accuse them of the specific, you know, person of the specific knowledge in an affidavit or, you know, in regards to the account or in regards to this, that, and the other. But it was almost like, you know, the special decoder ring or something that you find in Captain Crunch. Whenever you read it, and if you flip the script as if it was you writing the complaint, taking out certain excerpts from it, it laid it out beautifully on how to set something up to where it makes a pretty high obstacle for them to be able to, you know, come back at you. It shows you exactly what you need to point out in your complaint whenever you're, you know, writing your different violations out. Anyway, I noticed that, and I thought that was really – I was like, oh, thank you, Hannah Group.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah. Oh, it was good. I mean, CFPB laid
yeah.
it out And their motion to dismiss was just, I keep telling you, if anybody needs 51 pages to tell the truth, there's some garbage going on. Okay? There's some filler in surrounding the truth. Truth is not that long. The facts are usually not that long about anything. Okay? This wasn't a suit against the world. It was a suit against one debt collector mill that had done thousands of things that were similar. They were all the same. They were all the same. So when I looked at the complaint, and let me look at the complaint and see something right quick.
Yeah, I thought of billable hours when I saw the 51 pages. I'm like, 51 pages? Are you kidding me?
Now look at this. The CFPB's complaint, okay, and I'm going to give y'all my special number, 14 pages. 14 pages was their complaint. And the response was 4 times that amount, 5 times that amount, 51 pages. So out of thousands of foreclosures, the CFPB was able to consolidate their complaint into 14 pages, and their response was 51 pages. Now, what do you need 51 pages to answer to 14 pages? You understand? There's no reason for that. Absolutely not.
It's called confession. It's called confession.
That's what it is. That's the only thing it could be. I speak very short, plain, and to the facts. Okay? Rule 8. Short, plain statement of the facts, right? Short. Okay? So, 14 pages versus 51 pages on a motion to dismiss. Let me go into another thing that everyone should know about the CFPB. Is that the CFPB comes out with bulletins, and you should be on that site if you're serious about your consumer protection position. You should be on their site because they come out with bulletins that affects debt collectors. One of the important things I notice is that they've told creditors, they're bringing the creditors in, because as we know, some elements of consumer protection applies to creditors, especially if you're in California with the Rosenthal Act. The Rosenthal Act applies to creditors and debt collectors. Okay, so that's your state law, of course. But the CFPB came out with a law recently, a couple you need to take note of, and they have, I'm sure you guys and ladies know, the Dodd-Frank Act had put in, implemented some laws that the creditors must follow, okay? And the CFPB spends a lot of time reminding them of that and telling them, look, I'm going to tell y'all right now, this is for the creditors, or those of you who think you are, okay? They put the creditors on notice that unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices are a violation of the Dodd-Frank Act, okay? And they have jurisdiction over the Dodd-Frank Act, okay? So this is how they can go in on under their own set of laws. And one of the things that they told the debt collectors to be careful of is how you are handling your own debts, okay? And they said the effect of the notice is the extent is to extend the same rigorous requirements to original creditors that the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act currently imposes on third-party debt collectors. So you see that? They jumping in and making the creditors step back up their game. All right? One of the things they brought to light was you better not misrepresent the effects of payments on debt, on credit reports, scores, and credit worthiness. They know that not only are they stealing your properties, but they're ruining your credit to where you just can't do anything else. You shouldn't have that problem if you're here, but you just can't do anything else. Some of these companies are not even around. That's on your credit report, depleting your consumer purchasing power. They're dead. They're gone. They're bankrupt. And some of you are just not monitoring your credit report anyway, so it's not all their fault. You're not going in there and getting all of those things removed. but they're taking your property and then they're preventing you from moving on and getting some of the basic fundamentals of life. All right, so they said watch your credit reporting, watch your misrepresentations, all right, and be careful because we're watching you. All right, so the CFPB also, I just want to let you know, issues regulations that supervise covered banks and companies. Okay? Now, Dodd-Frank Act, it is 12 CFR 1080. 12 CFR 1080. That's your Dodd-Frank Act that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau delivers against even national banks. Okay? So, 1080.6, 12 USC, gives the CFPB broad powers to carry out the CIDs. All right? CIDs are civil investigative demands. All right? So they don't play. As they say home, they ain't no punks. All right? Another significant thing I want to point out about the CFPB and what they are doing. They had a meeting not too long ago, and they told everybody, the debt collector said, look here, as they say in the country, look here. I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you once and one time only. If you are contacting a consumer under the FDCPA about a time-barred debt, you better tell them it's time barred. Y'all better write that down. If a debt collector is dunning you about a debt and it's time barred, they must state that you have no obligation to pay the debt since they cannot take action because it's time barred. Let me put it in the proper way. You can pay them if you want to. And time barred only means they just can't sue you in court about the debt. Okay? Well, they can definitely ask you for it. Okay? So CFPB is saying you better have some language in there that says that the debt is time barred. Okay? Because why? I mean, let's think about it. Wouldn't that notice without that information give you the belief that you can be sued on it? Wouldn't it impose fear upon you, anxiety, because you're thinking you can be sued about it, which will probably encourage you to empty your savings to pay them? Of course. So CFPB is saying, you better tell them. Well, that can be a violation. All right, so these are the things we have to follow, and I'm sure a lot of you getting notices now. A lot of you in foreclosure. Many of you are past the statute of limitations. And those dunning notices don't say that. All right? Yours truly, Thor, had the opportunity to offer some kind companionship and camaraderie to a person that was able to survive a motion to dismiss dealing with a REMIC. I think I've said this before, and I'll say it again. And we have to listen, maybe with a different type of ear. Okay? There was an assignment, like you normally see, from a trustee 5 years past the statute of the cutoff and closing date of the REMIC. That assignment purported to assign the alleged debt to the REMIC 5 years after the closing date and the cutoff date of that particular trust. What the avatar Thor was able to say to this person was, why are you thinking that the REMIC is a creditor and the servicer is the only one that's a debt collector? This is going to help a couple of you, many of you. Does it make a difference who is what and who may call themselves a servicer or a waiter or a waitress or a ball bearer or a helper or the boss. Do those titles of nobility work, or are they relevant when there is a alleged debt that's being assigned after it is in default? I hear a lot of even attorneys out there talking about, yeah, well, you know, I see Remix filing in court as plaintiffs and the alleged servicer saying, yeah, we're the debt collectors. Really? Is the Remix not a debt collector if they obtain the debt? What makes you think the Remix is a creditor after a debt is in default? I see tens upon tens of cases, and everybody has a whiplash by thinking the Remix can be a creditor, and you're just going to argue the fact that, you know, the documents are late. When did they escape or avail themselves of that instrument that purports to assign the debt while it's in default? All of them are debt collectors, even the Remix. Well, how would you not think that everybody is debt collectors? But, I mean, I was talking to the gentleman's attorney. And I'm like, well, you're just going to challenge the assignments. I'm like, okay, well, hold up, time out. Let me offer you my opinion. Wouldn't the Remix be a debt collector too? Well, no, they're the creditor. Okay, well, you explain to me how they're the creditor then. What made them a creditor? Aside from the fact that it was assigned to them years after they were closed for business, essentially, how did they become a creditor and you're just going after the servicer? Wouldn't the Remix be a debt collector if they received the debt while it's in default? And I had to say that about three times, so he says, well, holy crap. Holy crap, Sharif, I guess. Wow, that does make sense. And, of course, y'all know I just smiled. I said, yeah, it does make sense. I did the Tony the Tiger on him. I was like, yeah, now you got it. Oh, I don't care who it is. If you get that debt while you're in default, there are no more creditors. Do you understand? There is no more creditors. Y'all playing this game, well, okay, they let the middleman come in and let the servicer act as the debt collector to shield the boogeyman creditor. Like, are you serious? Did you hear what the judge said in the Ocklin case? You bought the debt, Mr. Servicer. You're a debt collector. Now, what do you think Ocklin was saying all before that time? What kind of game do you think they were playing? In New York, you would know what I'm talking about. It's called three-card Molly. What do you think they were pleading and saying before that? Yeah, we're the servicer acting for the creditor, right? And the judge is like, nah, y'all just bought the debt, man. So in other words, the judge was like, there is no boogeyman. Okay? Right? Just like I say in my Maury Povich voice, Ocwen, you are not the creditor. You're not the father. Stop playing games. So let's understand that a debt collector is a debt collector is a debt collector. It's no musical chairs. The creditor died. The creditor's out the picture. The debt was assigned while I was in default. Okay? Once that transaction happened, I'll use one of the Patriots' slogans. That debt enters into a private realm where we don't know what, who, what, how much was paid, what paperwork was given, who, what, where. We don't know anything. All right? Let's understand that. Okay. Layla, if you would cue up that document that I sent you. My small lesson for today, and it's going to be a smaller one, is why is it that y'all some of you out there are allowing debt collectors, with all you've learned here and elsewhere, foreclose on you. I get emails upon emails where some of you great consumers are allowing debt collectors to pose as plaintiffs. Some of you are allowing servicers to foreclose on you. Servicers. Acting for the boogeyman creditor that doesn't exist. All right? Servicers falling for the word game. You know, I was talking with my team yesterday, and we were talking about different laws and just talking about current events, and, you know, I was hearing about different cases and matters, and I said, you know, it makes a difference what you are called and what you answer to. That's what law is all about. Who are you? Was one of the slogans that went around in the underground world. Know who you are, or who are you? And that's a very significant slogan because I think many of us don't know who we are, and we answer to people we are not. And we believe what we read, where people assert who they want to be rather than who they really are legally. Some of the words that I discussed on my call with my staff are some of the words that we fall for. And we've discussed many of them on the show, even outside the debt arena. You know, we've demonstrated to you that there are corporations, there are languages, there is legalese. There are other private corporations that are allowed. There are Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, military, fraternal organizations that create or have inherited a language, a description of what those people are within their society, within that society. As you know, when you're dealing with the courts, you're dealing with legalese. This is a Latin language. All right? Which means the words within that environment are disclosed in their own definitions and dictionary. And you don't know what those definitions are. So they come out into the public being a part of some organization. In every fraternity, there are certain words and certain descriptions, certain titles of nobility that may not be titles of nobility in the public, but in the private associations and groups and fraternities, they're able to name themselves what they want, call themselves what they want. You don't understand it if you are not a part of that society or group or gang, Crips, Bloods. They have signals. They have code words. They have slang. Law enforcement agencies have their own codes, 10-4, 10-3. Okay? In the normal world, you wouldn't know what those numbers or those words mean. So we attempt to break it down, and one of the slogans of Thor is identify, identify, identify. Who are you talking to before you talk? We know that in commerce, which is what we're dealing with, there is a language. Okay? There is the common English language that you and I refer to, are familiar with. And you can go to Webster's and you can go to a couple of dictionaries to find out the meaning of words used in the common English language. Okay? But when you start dealing with commerce and contracts and things of that nature, you agree to be bound by those words and the definitions that are sometimes explained, or sometimes there is a section or a glossary that has the meaning of those words, but many of y'all get into it and you don't understand legalese and you don't understand the words and you don't ask questions, so you become subject to a language that you're not familiar with. And you do it every day. We've explained to you the difference. Some of the words, let me give you a few words that is used that you need to know the definition of, or you will suffer the consequences or be disconnected from some of your money because you don't know better. Motor vehicle versus car or automobile. Who uses the word motor vehicle? Who created that word? Well, it's used in the Transportation Act, Motor Vehicle Act. It's a term that the legal society or the state created, therefore they have jurisdiction over that word. When they use that word and they call you by that name and you answer to it, then you accept the definition, which many of us realize we do. Well, we explain to you there's a difference in a motor vehicle and a car or automobile for purposes of law. There's a huge difference. There's a huge difference in driving, which is an occupation many of you do not engage in, and there's a difference in traveling. There was an article not too long ago where the CIA and Secret Service was recruiting people for their bureau that was very well versed with Ebonics. The reason why is that based on a lot of investigations they were doing in certain communities, specifically the black community, the boys in the hood were talking on the phone in a language they didn't understand. I think y'all seen some of that with the George Zimmerman trial when Trayvon's girlfriend was up there and some of the words and language she was using was foreign to us because they have their own language. And the CIA and the law enforcement community couldn't understand the language, therefore they couldn't really keep tabs on them and do a meaningful investigation because they didn't know what the hell they were saying. I guess now they know how it feels. Nonetheless, they were recruiting people that knew Ebonics. They will do that when they have Russian people over here. They're going to recruit somebody that speaks Russian. Okay? So the language makes a difference. People create their own languages all the time. The courts have their own language they create all the time. And when you go in there thinking you flapping your mouth and you don't know what it means, then that's how you get in trouble. Other words like children. Now I have to know that children is a legal word that they teach you coming up in public schools to make you think that you have children. I think many of you will be surprised that you might not have children. You might have kids. If you listen to the mother talk, and some people in the South, you might have churn. Or they may be your property. I don't know. Who determines what you name your own? Who determines that? In Spanish, there's the term, ¿cómo se llama? How are you called? And then say what your name is. How are you called? Okay? Other words that you need to understand, person, individual, citizen, resident, versus man, woman, American, inhabitant, domicile, debt collector versus creditor. All of these are words, legal words. And when you allow those words to be used against you and you answer to them and you respond to them and you don't object to them, then you become subject to the definitions that they have for them. if you were to go to Russia today, that language would probably be foreign to you, and you would probably not say much if a Russian person began to talk to you. What would you say? Oh, I don't understand. Or before you went, you would probably look up some words and make sure you're not being cussed out. Or the cab driver is not taking you to a dungeon instead of your hotel. So I think many of you on here are very intelligent. You would pick up a book with Russian words and definitions so you can pick up a good bit of what keywords you need to use or need to understand before you go there. Same thing with the court system. You need to know who's who, what's what. You need to know when they're talking to you that although those words are similar to those that you're familiar with in the English common language, they can mean something totally different. I am a part of a fraternity. The language is different. Totally different. And many times I am able to talk to people in my fraternity that you wouldn't have an idea what I'm saying, or you just may have thought that I was speaking those words in its plain and ordinary meaning in the common English language, to which we would laugh and be like, you really don't know what I'm talking about. You think you know, but you don't. We have to be important with words. We have to be important to understand, what words mean. And we have to understand when to be quiet and when to say, I don't understand, or I object to something that I don't understand, or ask a question, would you please define what you mean by that before I answer, so I don't think I'm answering to something that I think I know. I want to know I know. All right? Some of you are allowing debt collectors, and you already know because you email me and you come on the show and you listen, and everybody got it, right? Everybody understands. Yeah, they are debt collectors. Well, should I say that in the state court? For what? Some of you are allowing servicers to foreclose on you. Some of you don't know what holder versus holder in due course mean. Some of you, although you read all kind of pleadings and gurus provide you with all kind of motions, you still don't know what a plaintiff is. Have you looked it up? I mean, we know what the word plaintiff is. We know how to spell it. We know they're the ones who file a case. But do you know what a plaintiff means and what they can do, what they can't do? We know what a court is, but do we know how a court functions, what a court can do and what they can't do? What are the obligations of a defendant? What duties and responsibilities does he or she have? Do y'all know that? If many of you knew that, you wouldn't be in the position that you're in, allowing a servicer to file a case as a plaintiff against you, and you still talking about MERS or some documents. Filing cases, talk about they're the holder. Now, I've sent all of the people that are on our contact list a bunch of information about who's who and what's what, and I send you videos, and I only send you things that are important. And sometimes you may not understand it, but if you study it and you look at it with your mind's eye instead of your carnal eye, I think you would be able to see what's going on, because everything is not going to smack you upside the head. There is some allegory and mystery to things that are going on, and nobody's going to spell it out. It has to be figured out. But first you need to know who you are and who they are and what they can and what they cannot do. Did the Supreme Court in at least two cases, and I've sent you one and allowed you to watch the hearings where you had a bank attorney and a attorney for the homeowner. And I believe I sent to all of you at least two cases and videos. And the most important part of those videos was a couple of the Supreme Court justices, United States Supreme Court I'm speaking of, not your state Supreme Court, asking the bank attorney, who owns the loan? Who owns the loan? And y'all remember the Carpenter versus Longin case, the Ibanez case, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank. Y'all remember that in both of those cases, on live TV, at the highest court in this country, many of you talked about everything else other than the Supreme Court justice says, well, who owns the loan? And attorneys could not even answer the question. Well, you know, I don't, Judge, I don't know. Y'all heard it. They said, I don't know. Well, let me ask you a question. First thing I asked, too. How the heck did you get to the Supreme Court through some lower court, be it a circuit court, state court, federal court, through an appellate court, all the way up to a United States Supreme Court, and you don't know who the heck the creditor or the owner of the loan is? Okay? Now, I'm going to ask this simple question, because there were two attorneys there. And how did those two attorneys get to the Supreme Court and pass those other courts and not be able to answer that question? How did they get past you, the consumer, and not have the answer to the question to who the creditor is when someone filed a foreclosure and someone had their case adjudicated and it was determined that obviously, the court sided with the debt collector, I'm not going to even say creditor, to it was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and they get to the Supreme Court, and you mean to tell me they wasn't prepared enough to go up there and at least have an answer? Who owns the loan? I don't know. And some of you are allowing servicers to file foreclosures against you, or some of you in cases right now, and you don't even know. You see the word holder, and you don't know what a holder is. You would know if you were at the webinars. Everybody that's been at the webinars is pretty well equipped, but you don't know, and it's right there in front of you. Carpenter versus Long in Supreme Court said, you must be the owner of the mortgage and the note in order to foreclose. The Ibanez case, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank. Foreclosure conducted by non-mortgagee is wholly void and passes no title to a subsequent transferee. In other words, if you purchased a property at foreclosure and that foreclosure was not conducted by the owner of the mortgage and the note, then it says that foreclosure is wholly void and no good deed passes and no good title to even a bona fide purchaser, for those of you in non-judicial states or judicial states. We talked about in a couple of webinars setting aside a void judgment. Okay? That's your United States Supreme Court. Already told you, and yet some of y'all are allowing servicers and unknown parties and holders and sometime a mixture of both take your property And you're not even challenging it. Some of you are also are allowing summary judgment to be filed by a debt collector attorney, and their debt collector non-bank servicers who are debt collectors. And we all know that an affidavit has to be supported by summary judgment, and I really can't understand which affidavit would be appropriate to give a holder, or as the Supreme Court said, a non-mortgagee, or as the Carpenter-Logan case says, they're not even the owner of the note and the mortgage, and yet there's still cases going on to this day where you are allowing that. You're allowing debt collectors to come in with zero evidence, admissible or otherwise, doesn't matter. You're not filing any depositions. You don't have any competent fact witnesses. You haven't done any cross-examination. You haven't even countered. You've never seen anybody from the bank. You've never seen a witness from the bank. And you letting them appear through a defective affidavit. And then you're calling and you're, look, they're moving on me. You think? Who's moving on you? That's the first question. And you'd be surprised, they don't even know. So you've gotten this far. For some of you in New York, it takes 3 years to complete a foreclosure. 3 years! Sometimes longer to complete a judicial foreclosure process. 3 years! And that's not enough time for you to absolutely... I don't even get it. Do you understand that a debt collector, neither its counsel nor their statements in a trial setting now, are not sufficient for summary judgment or even a motion to dismiss? Did y'all know that? Let me get, what's this case that I'm... Trinsey versus Pagliaro. T-R-I-N-S-E-Y versus Pagliaro. I think it's P-A-G-L-I-A-R-O. Pennsylvania case. I'm paraphrasing. I might not be exact, but basically, essentially, it says statements of counsel in brief or in argument are not facts before the court. And they're insufficient for a summary judgment or motion to dismiss. What does that mean? That means that an attorney can't provide any evidence or testify or even throw you an affidavit by somebody else without you having the opportunity. Why are you guys not and girls not setting depositions, which are simple? Why are you not doing so? Because you're pro se? Well, I guess if you believe you're pro se, then that's probably one of the reasons why. We've already proven to you with cases, upon cases. Okay? And that's one of the things, y'all probably need to go read that Trinsey versus Pagliaro. In that case, there are no depositions, admissions or affidavits. The court has no facts. And if the affidavits are defective, then you need to point that out. And basically, that means there are no affidavits. No admissions, no depositions. I got to understand, professional statements of an attorney who is a debt collector as well are not treated as affidavits. They're not facts. And not knocking the attorney, but you need, again, you need to know who the players are. If that attorney is making statements for that plaintiff, he can be cross-examined regarding the substance of that statement. You got to have first-hand knowledge. Rule 56, summary judgment. The affidavit has to be based on first-hand knowledge. Who has first-hand knowledge of something, a transaction that you allegedly conducted 5, 10, 20 years prior to these debt collectors' existence? Who has it? You or them? And if they don't have a proper plaintiff, and the court was tricked into thinking they had the authority to adjudicate, then the court doesn't have jurisdiction, do they? If they come in and say, I'm Bozo the Clown, and you realize that they're the Roadrunner, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction over the Roadrunner, does the court have jurisdiction? No. That's why the first thing is a procedural attack. Who are you? Motion to dismiss. Let me check you out, make sure you are who you say you are. Supreme Court trumps everything. They've laid it out for y'all, and y'all still not using it. Okay? They have to be the real party in interest. They have to show an injury, financial one. Without that note, the alleged obligation, at least on that end of things, on the foreclosure end of things, if they can't show a legal injury, they don't have standing. You just can't go based on standing. The court can only make rulings on cases of controversy. There's no controversy if the parties are not properly identified or properly before the court. And if the court didn't have jurisdiction, I don't care when they entered it, you can always go back and challenge that. You find it in foreclosures, the court don't give a darn. They're going to assume jurisdiction if you're not pleading correctly. And we did a webinar on that. And a lot of people are getting a lot of success out of those specific webinars, knowing what to say, what not to say. And it's not much. Again, it doesn't take 51 pages. So we understand that by now, that foreclosure is debt collection if the debt was obtained while it was in default. We understand that. I don't think we have to go over that again. I still get a couple of emails here and there, but they must be people that just are now coming into that information. I don't think anybody has any doubt that that is clear. So I'm going to go over a case from the CFPB that will explain that to you in case you don't believe me. Or in case some of you want to say, hey, so-and-so over this website said that foreclosure is not debt collection. I was like, oh, nice. Okay. Right. The good thing about freedom is that you can make a choice. It was an old rap group. I forget who they were. And the title of the song was, you can get with this or you can get with that. Black sheep. Who's a black sheep? But you can get with this or you can get with that. You can get with Thor or you can get with more. I really don't care. I don't have to argue. But let me tell you what the CFPB says. Layla, if you would cue up, and would you go to page 17?
Okay.
Of an amicus brief by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. No, these are not the words of Thor, although they sound similar. But this was a case, and I'll give you the case because I want y'all to study. The case is Paul Birster, B-I-R-S-T-E-R, and Angela Birster are the plaintiffs and appellants against American Home Mortgage Servicing, Inc. Now, you heard what I said. Again, this shows you that a servicer was doing a doggone foreclosure. And let me say something on that right quick before I leave, because I got to address that. Okay? So you let somebody come in that's a middleman or woman, saying they work for this boogeyman creditor that you never met, you never got a notice from them, although your instruments say that the lender be able to do this and the lender be able to do that. You never heard from this lender, which is an indication that the boogeyman is dead. The boogeyman creditor is not around. You ever see those movies with the kids probably killed the parents and buried them in the back, and people be coming to the house looking for them. They're like, oh, they're sleeping, or they went out of town, they went on vacation. Then somebody gets suspicious because they come by and they haven't seen the parents in a while. Have you seen your parents in a while? Have you seen your creditor? Have you heard from them? Every time you send a letter, the kids are sending you a letter back. It's like, no, mom and dad is not here right now. They told me to take a message. The servicers say, no, creditor's not here right now. They told me to take a message. They told me I'm handling everything. What do you need? Do you not get suspicious and maybe wonder that there might not be a damn creditor around? So, you let the servicer come in and say, yeah, you know, we're the servicer and we're acting for the creditor and we have the authority and we're able to do what we need to do. And then you ask them, like the Supreme Court said, well, who's the creditor? Well, we don't know about that. We don't know about all that now. All I'm saying is that, you know, we can do what we do. And y'all don't challenge it. Y'all don't challenge it at all. Y'all go with the presumption that that servicer is acting for the boogeyman creditor you never heard from. You might have sent a QWR, if that's what you wanted to do, or notice of dispute to them directly. Let me ask you something. You run a company, right? And you have supervisors and department heads and all of that that work for you. And you're the CEO, right? And somehow your supervisors and your managers and your department heads didn't please a customer, right? And that customer made their way either through email or calling the CEO's secretary or something or another, and they made their way up to the boss. They sent a letter to the boss, said, look, your manager's treated me bad. Your people were rude to me. Your customer service sucks, right? All right? So as the CEO of the company, are you going to respond? Well, absolutely, especially when you're talking about my money. I'm going to respond and be like, which manager did you talk to? You talked to Layla? You talked to Rudy? You talked to Lori? They didn't handle you? They didn't take care of you? Rudy, Layla, Lori, come in my office. I got a customer here that's unhappy, said they wasn't treated right, they didn't get their modification paperwork, I had to get it 12 times, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Right? I know every last one of you would address that. Yet, everything you're getting is from a middle person. Did you not realize that the creditor's dead and buried somewhere and the kids have taken over the house and they're making believing like they're the parents, they're the creditors, and they're not? Let me ask you one more question. If Lori is my manager and she's telling that customer, well, I speak for the boss, you know, and the boss told me to tell you to, you know, you deal with me, right? What is that? Is that a fact or is that hearsay? Is that a fact or is that a hearsay? In my world, that's hearsay. Unless I hear from the boss or that boss writes me a letter or an affidavit, I don't believe anything you tell me. Yet, y'all believe them all the time. Okay? You don't know nothing until you know everything. Okay? They're going to come into court and tell you I got authority to foreclose. Well, who gave you the authority? I don't know, but I have it. Really? Well, who gave you that permission? I don't know, but it's allowed. Read your note. You don't even read the note. Speaking of a webinar Saturday, I had to make several individual calls because we're not used to going back to square one. And what's square one? We done ordered all these audits and title packages and sovereign packages and fingerprint knuckle packages and getting our passports in the name of our kids or whatever crap we're doing and putting vinegar and water on the letters and all that kind of stuff. We did all of that. Right? But we just didn't ask the right questions. So something would have to tell us is that they're moving on this contract that I signed. Why don't I go back to the contract and let's read it? And that's what we did this weekend. And I urge all of you, although I'm not going to teach the people that took an interest in their education, I'm going to urge all of you to go back and read your paperwork. I don't think you really understand what you're reading. Matter of fact, I know. I know many attorneys out there don't know what they're reading. Well, they might know. I think some of them don't. I think the ones that do know, they don't make the front page. They kind of keep it quiet. You need to read your mortgage. You need to read your note and see if everything they're saying is true and seeing if they're allowed to do everything they say they're allowed to do. Again, a creditor knows how much you owe them to a penny. If I'm a CEO and Lori makes me lose $100 and I got 10,000 customers, that's a lot of dang old money. I need to know where every penny is going. So, again, if that service is not exact and you have some questions they can't answer, when are you going to realize the parents are dead? The creditor is not around. You think as a CEO I'm not going to have a program that can add my money up to the penny? Or you think I'm going to have a calculator on the desk and have my managers like Lori and Layla and Rudy have calculators? What the hell are you doing with calculators? You better get the right equipment. You might be rounding up and whatnot. And if I got 1,000 of you rounding up, I'm losing a lot of money. Servicer can't speak for the agent, for the agency. They can only speak about what they know. And if they say they're a debt collector, how do you believe any damn thing they say and let them be a plaintiff in a case? Come on now. Layla, you ready?
I am.
All right, we're going to read to you the Burster case. This is, again, the CFPB came in with an amicus brief. Basically, they wanted to come in the case and throw a little CFPB perfume on the case to let the court know what fragrance they should be smelling. And they'll be falling for that, the Willy Bobo that these servicers and debt collectors are trying to pull. All right, Layla, start at page 17C, proceedings below, and then read until I tell you to stop, and I might stop you in between. So listen carefully.
Oh, wait, proceedings below. Okay, maybe we're not on the same page. 17 of the document, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Section C, proceedings below.
Oh, section C. Page 17 says B. The additional definition of the debt collector?
No. Are you on the right one? Page 17 starts out their debt even though?
No. Mm-mm.
All right. Wait a minute. Oh. Wait. Okay, I'm sorry. It's the document page 17 on the actual – it's page 8 of the document.
Oh, okay. 8 of go. The document?
Yeah, I have oh. – right.
Okay, all right. I wanted to make sure. Okay, proceedings below. All right. Okay, this is a case of Burster, B as in boy, I-R-S-T-E-R versus American Home Mortgage Servicing. And can I just say one thing? You know, when Brother Sharif talked about the amicus brief. I looked that word up, amicus curiae, and what that means is friend of the court. And what that means is it's the name of a brief filed with the court by someone who is not a party to the case. And I'm like, I was thinking, wow, my hair stood on end. I'm like, the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau is filing a brief on behalf of these people. And that's amazing. But anyway, proceedings below. The Burster sued American Home Mortgage under the FDCPA and related state laws. American Home Mortgage moved for summary judgment on several grounds, including that its conduct was not a debt collection subject to the Act because it related to foreclosing on a mortgage. The district court granted summary judgment to American Home Mortgage on the FDCPA claim and remanded the remaining claims to state court. The court concluded that the FDCPA claim filed as a matter of law because the alleged conduct related to enforcement of a security interest and therefore was not debt collection covered by the Act. The court also appeared to conclude that American Home Mortgage qualified as a debt collector for the purposes of 1692 F6 and that the Bursters therefore could not assert claims under other provisions. The Bursters appealed. Okay, summary of argument. To state a claim under most provisions of the FDCPA, a plaintiff must show both that the defendant is a debt collector and that the challenge conduct related to, that the challenge conduct related to debt collection. Let me repeat that again. To state a claim under most provisions of the FDCPA, a plaintiff must show that the defendant is a debt collector and that the challenge conduct related to debt collection. The court below concluded that because American Home Mortgage was involved in a foreclosure, it did not qualify as a debt collector, and its actions in this case did not relate to debt collection. These conclusions misconstrue the FDCPA. Debt collector. The FDCPA generally defines debt collector as an entity whose principal purpose is debt collection and who regularly collects or attempts to collect a debt under 15 U.S.C. 1692A6. Under an additional definition applicable for purposes of a single provision, 1692F6, the term debt collector also includes any entity whose principal purpose is the enforcement of security interests, like categories of people who specifically excluded from the definition of debt collector, such as 1692A6, letters A through F, enforcers of security interests do not appear on that list. Courts have concluded that enforcers of security interests qualify as debt collectors only for the purposes of 1692F6, have failed to consider that enforcers of security interests may also regularly collect debt and thus qualify as debt collectors under the general definition. Recognizing that an entity may meet both the general and the additional definition does not render the additional definition superfluous. Some enforcers of security interests, such as repossession agencies that rarely contact debtors, constitute debt collectors only under the additional definition, while others, like entities that initiate foreclosure proceedings and then seek payment in lieu of foreclosure, both regularly collect debts and principally enforce security interests. The additional definition requires the former category of people to comply with the 1692F6, even though they are not generally subject to the Act, meaning the FDCPA. By the Act's plain terms, an entity that meets both definitions of debt collector qualifies as a debt collector for purposes of the entire Act. The additional definition.
Hold up! All right there. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So did everybody hear that? And I want everybody to understand what the CFPB said. By the Act, plain terms, an entity that meets both definitions of debt collector, okay, and we know what a debt collector is and is not, okay, 1692A6, okay, a debt collector that meets both definitions of a debt collector qualifies as a debt collector for purposes of the entire Act. In other words, if you fit into both categories, you fit into the entire act, not just one section, which you'll hear a lot of these debt collectors masquerading as creditors. They'll try to pull the 1692F6, the security enforcer. Who was just enforcing the security interest? Okay? That's just one section. That means the rest of the sections still apply to you. It didn't exclude enforcers of security interests. You heard her say it includes them. Didn't exclude them. Okay? So go ahead, Layla.
The additional definition does not exclude enforcers of security interests from the general definition, but rather also includes them for purposes of a particular provision. Notably, unlike other entities, enforcers of security interests are not explicitly excluded from the definition of debt collector. Nearly every court, including every federal appellate court that have considered this question, agrees. This conclusion is also consistent with a prior administrative interpretation of the Act and furthers the Act's consumer protection purposes.
Hold on right there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So did y'all hear that? The CFPB is telling the court, okay, the one trial court who wants to rule that, well, no, they're enforcing a security interest. Did y'all hear what they said? They said nearly every court, including every they said, federal appellate court to have considered this question agrees. But they're not excluded from the definition of a debt collector. This conclusion is consistent with the prior administrative interpretation of the Act and furthers the Act's consumer protection purposes. Every court, so when we get knuckleheads talking about, hey, so-and-so said that enforcing a security interest is not not debt collection action. All right? Y'all want to take the word of the CFPB? Oh, y'all want to take the word of Jack Blue over there? All right, so go ahead, Layla.
An entity that satisfies both definitions of debt collector remains a debt collector subject to the entire FDCPA, even if it's enforcing a security interest in a particular case. That an entity is enforcing a particular security interest, let me repeat that. That an entity is enforcing a security interest in a particular case bears on whether its actions constitute debt collection, not on whether the entity is a debt collector. The
Time
statute
out.
Defines. Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Sound a little bit confusing, right? So the CFPB said what we said all the time: behavior and conduct, how they're treating you, even if they're the creditor and they're treating you as if you are in default, that creditor can become subject to the FDCPA. So it says that an entity is enforcing a security interest in a particular case, okay, bears on whether its actions, what are you asking me for? Are you demanding me? Am I in default? Are you telling me to pay something? Are you telling me when? What are you doing? What's your actions? Are you treating me like it's in default, or me and you still cool? We still friends? You telling me just catch up, just get it together, we still going to be all right? Or are you treating me like a consumer that's in default? So it bears on whether its actions constitute debt collection, not on whether the entity is a debt collector. What does that mean? That means a creditor can be considered a debt collector based on their actions. Did y'all hear that? Let me say that again, because let me go lower with it, okay? Based on your behavior, okay, determines whether you're a debt collector. Not that you say it, not that you've made the transition yet with an assignment or you've transferred it. Y'all see how deep this is going? No, I'm smart enough as a consumer to know that you're talking to me like a kid and I'm an adult. So it makes no difference that I'm an adult. It's how you're treating me. You're treating me as a kid and I'm an adult. So therefore, since you're treating me like a kid, I'm going to hold you responsible for your conduct in treating me like a kid, although I'm an adult. So you're a creditor, supposedly, enforcing a security interest, but nah, you're not. You're treating me like a doggone consumer that's defaulted on some obligation. And you have people calling me and contacting me, and you're sending me letters identical to debt collectors. So regardless of what you say you are, right? Regardless of whether you've made the transition and sent it over to a debt collector, you acting like one right now. Go ahead, Layla.
The statute defines debt collectors by reference to their principal purpose and regular activities, not their activities in a particular case. Section 1692IA1, which regulates debt collectors enforcing security interests in real property, confirms that...
Stop. You knew I was going to stop y'all there, right?
Yeah.
All right? Now, what... Sam, where's Sam at? Bring Sam in. Let the student come over here. Sam, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Did you just hear what Layla just said?
Yes, I did.
What did you get out of that?
Well, they were clear in defining the difference between the creditor and a debt collector.
Okay. What else did you get out of that?
Basically, that was it.
Okay. Well, let me read to y'all 1692I, which a lot of people have a confusion about. Now, go ahead and mute up for me, Sam, if that's the train. Why would the CFPB point out 1692I, which many people don't talk about, which many people who do talk about it misconstrue it? 1692I, legal actions by debt collectors. Venue is A, comes under venue. Any debt collector who brings any legal action on a debt against any consumer shall, one, which is what the CFPB just quoted, in the case of an action to enforce an interest in real property, securing the consumer's obligation, bring such action only, not maybe, not if you feel like it, in a judicial district or similar legal entity in which such real property is located. So for those of you in California, Colorado, Washington, and any other state that does non-judicial foreclosure, and you have an assignment of that debt while it is in default, and you're being threatened that these people masquerading as creditors are going to take a non-judicial action trying to piggyback on the lane of a creditor when they are clearly a debt collector, and the CFPB just told you that. Okay? So I'm going to read to you, and this is why I say to you, nobody's going to spell it out and hit you in the head with it but Thor. And sometimes I don't feel we should do that either. Why do you think the CFPB even mentioned 1692I? What was the hint there? We didn't hear about what kind of foreclosure it was. They were just talking about 1692F6, the debt collector saying, well, no, we're just enforcing a security interest and, you know, we're not debt collectors, right? So the CFPB says Section 1692IA1, I just read to you, which regulates debt collectors enforcing security interest in real property, confirms that entities enforcing the security interest in a particular case can qualify as debt collectors under provisions other than 1692F6. I'm going to read that one more time. Section 1692IA1, which regulates debt collectors enforcing security interest. Did you see the switch? Did y'all see the Kobe Bryant crossover right there? Being that you, Mr. Debt Collector, you mentioned enforcing a security interest in real property,
right? Let me flip you over here. Let's go to the back of the book for a minute. And let me show you 1692 IA1. By the way, that regulates you, too, as debt collectors enforcing your security interests, which, by the way, is in real property. It's not a utility bill. Confirms that you, my man, enforcing that security interest in a particular case, like you don't even have to do it for a living. Like you don't even have to do it every time. It's on a case-by-case basis. Did you know you can qualify as a debt collector under 1692 F6? This is on page 11 of that amicus brief. And for those of you in non-judicial states that have any question about 1692I on how they have to take a judicial action against you, not any non-judicial foreclosure, that was reserved for a creditor. And the CFPB is throwing the hint. For those of you that read and read with understanding, by the way, and I haven't read anywhere in here whether they did a non-judicial foreclosure. I don't even know. But I know when I read that, it told me to go look because I know they're not saying it for any reason. Okay? So take that back to your communities and tell them what the CFPB said. All right? You're supposed to be taking that case judicially, and it appears, I'll bet you $100 that they did a non-judicial action. All right? 1692 IA1. Go, Layla.
Because American Home Mortgage did not contest below that it regularly collects debt, it constitutes a debt collector for purposes of the entire FDCPA. Debt collection. Hmm. Attempting to obtain payment of a consumer debt constitutes debt collection covered by the FDCPA. In this case, called Hines versus Jenkins, U.S. 291-294-1995. Nothing in the Act suggests that seeking payment from a debtor ceases to qualify as debt collection if it accompanies proceedings to enforce a security interest.
Stop.
That conclusion was... Mm-hmm.
Nothing in the Act suggests that seeking payment, okay, not an NREM action, but seeking payment, if you ask me for $2.50, I don't care what you're enforcing, a tattoo, a lien, a roof, a deer, if you ask me for money, it qualifies as debt collection. It doesn't matter what it is. But it says even if you're enforcing a security interest. So let's stop all the nonsense that because you dealing with my property that it ceases to exist as a debt, it's a damn debt under A5, and you're asking me for money. And there's money regarding a debt, not debt collection. Again, I don't care how you – again, this is why I tell you, you have to know it for yourself regardless of what they say on the letter, whether they put it on the letter or not. Because what do they put on these notice on these Dunning notice? We may be a debt collector. Oh, I'm gonna sue you. You may be. Oh, you don't know? Well, I'm gonna make sure you know at the end of the day. What do you mean you may be a debt collector? Either you are or you're not. That's deceptive. Okay. Why would you even put it in there if you didn't think you was? Do you think you're a monkey? So you around there? I may be a monkey, but sometimes you know I act like a human being. All right, go ahead, Layla.
That conclusion would create an enormous loophole allowing debt collectors to abuse consumers with impunity whenever they happen also to seek to enforce a security interest. Every federal appellate court that has published a decision on this issue and nearly every other court agrees. Although the district court suggested that pursuing foreclosure by itself cannot constitute debt collection covered by the Act, the court need not reach that question here. At a minimum, seeking payment from a debtor unquestionably qualifies as debt collection, even if it occurs in the context of foreclosure proceedings. The Bursters allege that American Home Mortgage repeatedly attempted to induce them to pay amounts owed on their mortgage. That was debt collection, even though it occurred in the context of foreclosure proceedings. Now, here's the argument. The FDCPA protects consumers by, among other things, prohibiting debt collectors from engaging in unfair, abusive, or deceptive debt collection practices, requiring debt collectors to cease contacting a debt collector or about a debt of a debtor so demands or is represented by counsel, and obligating debt collectors to verify disputed debts and to notify debtors of their dispute rights. Under 15 U.S.C. 1692 C through G, that's what that was about. Two threshold.
Okay. All right, you can stop there. And the rest of it, y'all can read on your own. But
all right,
I'm going to end it there and tell you, all right, how your CFPB was able to make clear to all of you that, and if you were reading with understanding, you would understand that they extended the definition somewhat when you think about it, because they said, we know that as a debt collector, when you look at 1692A6, it means any person who uses the instrumentality of interstate commerce and the mails who regularly collects or attempts to collect. All right? That's the definition. But you, if you see within their amicus brief, they went further to say that, look, you can even be doing it on a case-by-case basis. And it depends on your conduct, even as a creditor. I've told y'all before that even a creditor can become subject to the FDCPA based on what? The way their conduct, how they're treating you. But if y'all didn't catch the Kobe Bryant crossover where the CFPB told all of y'all, y'all keep coming in here talking about that 1692 F6 security enforcer, we just want to let y'all know, if you out there security enforcing, you better be doing it judicially, as 1692IA1 says. If you didn't get anything out of that order, for those of you in non-judicial states, I don't know what else you're looking for. If you experienced a non-judicial foreclosure and it was not done in compliance with 1692IA1, you had a wrongful debt collection action. Plain and simple. If someone is threatening you today, saying, I'm about to sell your house at our company picnic in the backyard, okay? Which is, y'all be surprised, they tell you they're selling it at the doorstep, at the courthouse step, y'all don't know if it was sold or not. But under 1692E, and like Lori said, you can throw the book at them. If you go under 1692E5, the threat to take any action that cannot legally be taken or that is not intended to be taken. Simple as that. Okay? If you threaten that you're going to do a non-judicial foreclosure in violation of 1692IA1, I can sue you because that's a threat you cannot legally. All right? Let me tell you other cases. Give you a few cases for y'all to write down. That says foreclosures are actionable under the FDCPA, like they need to say it. Again, you need to know it. Federal Home Loan Mortgage, y'all know who they are. Lettenmaier, L-E-T-T-E-N-M-A-I-E-R. The Lettenmaier, in Lettenmaier, the court found, and the gentleman asked this question last week.
Say, well, Brother Sharif, you know, Mr. Skarskowski over there says, the trustees are not debt collectors.
And I said, oh, wow. Wow.
Do you want to comment on that? And, you know, they had the CNN news truck out there, and they caught me and Thor coming out, and they said, do you want to comment on that? I said, well, I looked into the camera, and I said, well, trustees are not debt collectors. And he says, well, yeah, that's what he said. I said, yeah, that's what you don't understand.
No, a trustee. In that capacity, how can a trustee be a debt collector? Some of y'all don't listen when people talk, and you don't listen to yourself talk. How can a trustee be a debt collector. We've told you over and over again, either you are or you're not. In slang, you is or you ain't. If you're a debt collector, are you a trustee? Or you're a debt collector acting like a trustee? Or you're a debt collector acting like a creditor? If you're a creditor, are you a creditor and a debt collector? Or are you a debt collector acting like a creditor? Or are you a creditor acting like a debt collector, like the CFPB said? Your conduct. Which one are you? So, the Lettenmeyer case, guess what? The court found the trustee was, in fact, what? What Maury Povich said? You are the debt collector. Under 1692, guess what? 1692F6, which we just talked about, and therefore refused to dismiss the FDCPA claim. Wow. That was against your big boys, Federal Home Loan Mortgage. Give you another case. Armacost, ARMOCOST versus HSBC Bank. The judge sought the outside guidings of the definition, guidance on the definition of debt collector in the FDCPA. In response to the report that was submitted, the court found that parties attempting to enforce a security interest with no present right to do so, which is most of your cases, were found to be actionable under the FDCPA, 1692F6. Okay? So just because they say they're enforcing a security interest, you believe them? What if there is no debt there? What if the remedies are closed and already done and all that, you know, credit default swap, insurance bailout, all that? What if there really is no debt? Did y'all consider that? Then in that case, can the court determine on a 12B6, is this your case, deep six your case? Because there's a material issue of fact, I need to determine whether they are debt collectors. I don't believe anything they say. I need to find out. So I'm saying, nah, I don't know nothing about that debt. Nah, man. Wasn't me. I don't recall. I fell down the steps. Don't remember. You got to give me some evidence. Jog my memory. Katz, KATZ, versus Aurora Loan Services. In this case, the court found that Aurora was a debt collector as they received the assignment of the note 2 days after the notice of default had been filed. I'm telling you, many of y'all will find that. Sometimes you see the assignment after they filed the foreclosure. They filed the foreclosure first and didn't get the assignment until later, but you're not paying attention. There's a few more cases. Kaltenbeck, K-A-L-T-E-N, B-A-C-H versus Richards. Okay? Basically saying that a party who satisfies 1692A6 general definition of a debt collector is a debt collector for the purposes of the entire FDCPA when enforcing security interests. Where do you think they got that language from? Hint, CFPB. Wilson versus Draper and Goldberg, PLLC. Wilson's debt remained a debt even after, y'all listen to this. Y'all check it out. Court said in Wilson versus Draper and Goldberg, PLLC, Wilson's debt remained a debt even after foreclosure proceedings commenced. Well, what do you think that means? Maybe you can dispute the debt at any time? Or somehow because they filed for foreclosure, that doesn't mean that they become a creditor because they filed for foreclosure? Court said it remains a debt, even after foreclosure. Still a debt, still an A5. Doesn't matter. Garbage in, garbage out. Okay? I'll give you another one for those of you post-foreclosure, dealing with eviction. Romea, R-O-M-E-A, versus Heiberger, H-E-I-B-E-R-G-E-R, and Associates. This is out of the Second Circuit. Concluding that an eviction notice required by statute could also be an attempt to collect the debt. Let me ask you a question. You're in California. You're in Colorado. You're in other non-judicial states. And I've already broken down to you to notice a trustee sale in California. Complete joke. They don't know if they're selling lien or junior lien or they're not really selling the property. They tell you right there, they're not selling the property. They're selling a lien. Is a lien not a debt under A5? Is a lien not a debt under A5? Okay. So if the lien is a debt under A5 and a debt collector sold that lien to a purchaser for value, Bubba and them, went down there with a money order, say, I'm going to buy that boy property over there, man. I'm going to get that one right there. I'm going to get that farm in foreclosure. They had a bad time. And it was in default, and they sold it to Bubba, and Bubba's going to show up at the house and say, you need to get out. I purchased that property. Bubba get hit in the head with the notice of dispute because Bubba did what? Bubba didn't buy the property, first of all, but besides that, Bubba just bought a debt. And it says that he bought a debt. What do you think? You bought a debt from a debt collector and somehow you become a creditor because you paid for it? Well, the debt collectors paid something for it too. Did they not? 5, 10 cent on a dollar, 20 cent on a dollar, who knows? But because you sold it, does that mean somehow at the other end it turns from a debt to a credit? You heard what the court just said. It remained a debt even after foreclosure commenced. It's not going to change later. It doesn't change back. It's not the Incredible Hulk. We go from David Banner to the Incredible Hulk and back to David Banner. No, he stays the Hulk, stays a debt. So, Mr. Purchaser, for value, you're a debt collector. You're still trying to collect the debt. They just passed it off to you. It's football. They got the hot merchandise over their hand and put it in your hand, and you coming over here in your pickup truck, acting like you're about to kick me out of my house. No, you're about to be a defendant. You better run back and try to get your money back. Quite simple. I mean, at least I think it is. All right. I want to say one more thing, and I want to say this again. If your plaintiff is not the lender and you contest standing, the court has an obligation. The court has an obligation because the court is the one that has the authority in matters of a controversy. Okay? That means the real party in interest and the real debtor has an issue with the contract. If somebody's not party to your contract, how you allow them to talk about a contract? That's a private contract between you and another party. So why are you so quick to be discussing your personal business with somebody because they're able to print out some documents from the county and misconstrue it and mangle it tremendously, and you don't even know, like a hint, well, the borrower is in default. Huh. The borrower is in default. Layla, Lori.
Yes.
Can I ask you a question? If a homeowner is in default, does that mean that even a creditor can foreclose on a default alone?
No.
Oh. You serious? Sam.
I'm here.
Samage.
I'm here.
Can a creditor foreclose on a homeowner because they are behind in payments just based on a default? You wasn't there this weekend, so I'm just giving you a shot. I'm not going to hold you accountable.
Okay. No, they have to prove that they're in default. They have to prove
okay.
that the homeowner is, in fact, in default.
Okay. So what if they prove that they're in default? Then what happens?
Then they have to allege that they are actually the owner of the note mortgage, and they have to prove that. They have to
oh,
prove
okay.
that
That's
they
it?
Loaned them the money.
Right.
They have to prove that they loaned them that money.
Right. Okay. Anything else?
That's it.
That's it?
That's it.
Okay. That's why I brought you to the front of the class. Anybody in the chat want to answer that question right quick? If a creditor, you're behind in your mortgage payments, some of you in the chat might be real estate brokers. If you are in default, you didn't pay two payments on your mortgage, okay, and the creditor said you're in default, what happens next? Can they foreclose after you're in default? Or is there something else they're supposed to do? Nobody in the chat?
Yeah, they do have
Come on, Zay, let's take a swing at it. Come on, Mr. Bonnie, take a swing at it. You're in default. You missed two or three payments. What does the creditor have to do? Okay. Anybody want to take a swing at it?
They have to give you an opportunity to cure.
Oh, all right, good. All right, look, opportunity to cure. I like that. All right. Opportunity to cure, right? Cure means fix it. Heal the default, right? Then what? What if you don't cure? Do they give you a time to cure?
Well, yes. They have to give you an opportunity to cure. They have to give you a timeline for it, yes.
All right. Oh, they give you a timeline. Okay, now you're getting warm. So you missed two payments, and the bank say, hey, Sam, look, man, you're in default, man. You gotta catch these payments up. That's what they tell you, Sam?
Yeah, they send you a notice of acceleration. But your contract must show, they must go by your contract.
Wait a minute. What did you say? You said what? You said they send you what?
They send you a notice of acceleration.
Oh, they do? What is acceleration, Sam?
That's where they move everything into one lump sum and determine that this is what you owe.
So the unpaid principal balance. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay.
And they have to abide by your mortgage conditions preceded prior to foreclosure.
Oh, you're trying to get fancy. Oh, so conditions preceded. So what is conditions preceding? Sam?
Sam knows this. I know he does.
Yeah, there are items that they must perform prior to bringing any legal action.
Okay, so a condition preceding can be some action that they must take within the content of the mortgage or the note. Okay, so Mr. Bonney said a notice of acceleration. Sam said acceleration. So what is acceleration? Well, acceleration is basically increasing speed, right? So in other words, a default is, Sam, give me your money. You're behind two payments. We still cool. We're going to play golf. But you got to catch those payments up, right? And then I'm going to give you a time frame to do that. I'm going to give you by September the 1st. Like, get your money up. All right, catch that up. You're in default. All right? And then there's some language that goes along with that, usually in the note and or the deed or the mortgage. Right? And it usually tells you how they have to handle a default. And one of the options is they may accelerate the note. They said may. So they say, Sam, catch up on these payments. If you don't catch up on these payments by September 1st, I may accelerate the mortgage. Sam, was your mortgage ever, your note ever accelerated?
Yes, it was. They sent a notice of acceleration. Yes, indeed.
Really? Did it say a notice of acceleration or a notice of intent to accelerate, or was it a notice just saying we have accelerated the loan?
I can't remember if it said intent at that particular time.
Well, intent to accelerate and accelerate would make a difference, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
So if I gave you a date by which to do something within the contract, and I said, Sam, if you don't do it within that amount of time, then I may do something to you, but I don't say whether I'm going to do that. Did I do it, or did I threaten to do it?
You actually threatened to do it.
Okay. So what would be an indication that look, Sam, look, September 1st passed, you didn't pay your default payment, I told you I may go on and accelerate, what would be the next thing I would have to do?
Outside of conditions precedent, precedent?
Well, we're in the conditions. The condition is I have to give you notice of what I'm going to do. I told you by September 1st you need to catch up your payments. And if you didn't, I may accelerate the loan after that. So what would I have to do after that? Layla, Lori?
You'd have to accelerate it.
Uh-huh. Right. And if my three-step level is I got to send you out a notice of default, those of you in California, elsewhere, that's what you get. Many of you elsewhere get a notice of default, correct? And they say, well, I'm default you. That default means, you know, you didn't meet some payment obligation. All right? And many of you got a notice and said, if you don't act by this particular day by curing the default, I may accelerate. Accelerate meaning I'm calling the entire loan due. The unpaid principal balance is going to be due. Okay? If you don't do it by the first. So the next thing I have to do is what? Send you a notice that, look, I decided that that is what I'm going to do. I'm accelerating your loan, meaning no more payments are due. You have to pay the entire balance. Okay? Got to pay the entire balance. And I'm entitled, or at least I say I'm entitled to all interest and fees and attorney fees and everything and cost involved with me proceeding to foreclosure on that unpaid balance, and I'm able to accrue interest and all that good stuff. That's how it should go. Now, I'm going to ask everybody out there, is that what you experience? I will bet that 8 out of 10 of you never received a notice of default. I mean, a notice of acceleration. Not a notice of intent, like you would in California. Intent just means I'm thinking about it. Where is your notice of acceleration? Where is your notice saying that no payments are due? Because you know they always offer you a modification up until they can file foreclosure, still be offering you modification. Once you get into acceleration, what is due? Everything. Right? Everything is due. No payments. Everything is due. Where's your notice? What's your acceleration notice? Right? Right? And let me tell you one other little hint. If I tell Sam, you don't pay those payments by September 1st, then I'm accelerating the mortgage. I may accelerate the mortgage. And that means by September the 1st, hasn't that threat become a maturity? Meaning that I didn't act by that particular date, so the time for me to act expired before you actually accelerated the note. Right? So that means you couldn't accelerate it anyway because your notice expired, matured, and the maturity date came prior to the acceleration. So if I accelerate your loan, am I really entitled to interest and fees and attorney fees and corporate advance fees and Christmas parties and everything else they throw in there? Are they really entitled to it? Well, they say they are in the note, right? I'm going to leave it there. Go read your damn note and tell me whether they can get interest and fees or whether they accelerate it. Can you go from default to foreclosure without an acceleration, a clear acceleration? Go read your note. Go tell your gurus and everybody else to go read the note and go read the law and tell me what, although people say conditions preceding, tell me what may have been skipped in those conditions preceding. Did they do everything by the contract? I don't think so. I'm just telling you, I've seen them. I just don't think so. All right, we're done. 657-383-0332. You got questions, comments, concerns? Let's get it in. We have 10 minutes left in the live stream. Those of you in the chat that want to continue on need to call in. Thank everybody for participating in the chat. Zaya said notice of default, notice of foreclosure. Zaya, they can't go from a default to a foreclosure. A foreclosure is an acceleration, so to speak. If they didn't give their intent to accelerate or they didn't tell you they were accelerating, how can they go in there and ask for all the money and they never ask you for all the money? Can foreclosure be the first time they ask you for all of the money? Oh, let's read our notes and our deeds. Let's read under default. Let's go check it out. Let's see what it says. Let's see if it is what it is. Well, if it ain't what it ain't. All right, let me go over here. Maynard.
Yes, brother.
Man, can somebody foreclose on you, man, without asking you for all the money first?
No, sir.
You sure?
I am 100%.
So you saying when these debt collectors send you a letter and say, give me them 24 months in payments, and you go to court and they say, he still owed 24 months in payments and 6.75 interest for since the last time he made a payment, which was 2 years ago, and we're entitled to all them attorney fees and all that there, and we filed the foreclosure because he's in default? Are you saying that there's something wrong with that?
Absolutely.
No. Man, they do that all the time, man.
Every day.
man. So somebody's not abiding by the contract?
Nobody
skipped a step. No, nobody didn't skip a step. Come on, man. These are creditors, man. You know, come on. The creditors, they don't do that. They follow the contract, which is the law, right? They wouldn't take you into court and they haven't abided by the law, would they?
No, they wouldn't do that. Sure, they wouldn't.
No, no. They're honorable people, man. They're honorable. And then ask you for, you know, some lettuce and tomatoes and onions and pickles on top of the burger, right? They want fees and charges and interest, you know, all that.
Wow.
And they may not be entitled to that? That would be crazy. Now,
wait
a minute. Not only would that be a problem within the contract itself, Lori, what else would it might be a problem with?
All your state statutes, as well as the FDCPA, as well as on and on and on.
Oh, like 1692E?
92E?
Yeah, just rip it off.
For misrepresenting the character,
the
amount, legal status of the debt? Oh, so you're saying default is a legal status of the debt? Oh, so you're saying if you miss one of them steps and you were supposed to give me a couple of other notices prior to you taking that action, that means you might have misrepresented some of the information. And they wouldn't do that because that would be a violation of the FDCPA, right? Well, let's look at 1692F because, you know, they like to be in F6. So while they hanging out in the F bar on 1692F, talking about, yeah, we're just enforcing the security interests under F6, you know. We're like, okay, well, why are you in F6? Why don't you stop by over there at F1 and tell me that the collection of any amount, including interest, fee, charge, or expense, incidental to the principal obligation, unless such amount is expressly authorized by the agreement, meaning the mortgage, the deed, the note. And you mean to tell me that if they misrepresented that, that would be an unfair practice under 1692F? Oh, my goodness. Man. Oh, my goodness. That would be ridiculous. Now, who would do something like that?
I know if
97% of my consumers didn't know any better, I'd try it on.
I'd say everybody's a 1692A6. Boom. Period. Period.
You're talking about in all the foreclosures you've seen, they all ask for interest and fees and attorney fees and payments and saying that the note authorized them to do so.
Oh, man.
I
couldn't sleep after Saturday. I don't think I slept.
Oh, really? You didn't sleep? you wasn't used to sleeping with a hammer in your hand, huh?
The hammer kept me up.
I kept pounding him in the head like a pat of me.
He kept twisting and turning and hit himself in the head. He kept like, what is all this going on? Bumps on your head. I don't know. That hammer was just doing its own thing last night. So you mean to tell me that they've been asking y'all for interest and they leave it open now? Listen, they leave it open. I mean, they say, we're gonna let this debt mature, okay? We're going to let it mature because it's collecting interest. Now, let me tell y'all one other thing. Do y'all know that if somebody's charging you monthly interest on a debt that pursuant to the Truth in Lending Act, they have to send you a monthly statement? Wait a minute. Let me give y'all another indication. Are your servicers, so-called, sending you a monthly statement with interest, payments, default amount, monthly payments, and you in foreclosure? Oh, my goodness. If you're in default and your loan hasn't been accelerated, then how are they sending you monthly statements? And if they're not sending you monthly statements, then that's a problem. So they make you think you've been accelerated when clearly you haven't because you don't have any notice of acceleration. And they let it sit there for a year or two because, you know, they're busy, you know, doing 325,000, you know, illegal foreclosures, debt collection, right? And there's a little known word called laches, L-A-C-H-E-S. Let me read to you what that is. It's an unreasonable delay pursuing a right or claim in a way that prejudices the party. So they didn't accelerate you. Instead, or maybe they did accelerate you and let the thing sit there for a year or two or three while it's gaining interest. And they said, okay, yeah, we built up enough steam. We're going to file right now, and you owe us another $200,000 in fees and interest and everything else. Would laches not apply? Huh? That reasonable delay in pursuing your claim that you're letting it sit up there. You think you're going to collect interest, but once you get in front of me, you're going to realize that you wasted your time for nothing and probably told some more statute of limitation time for you. So, and then you're going to get hit with the laches, and then you're going to hit with, oh, you think you can collect interest? Show me. Okay? I'm just telling y'all better get on it, Dirk, on it. I don't think none of y'all got a notice of acceleration. I've seen 1,000 foreclosure cases. I see notices of default. I see that all the time.
I see you go to court, and they'd be like, well, you want to go out the hallway and talk about a modification? Well, hold on. If I can get a damn modification, that means you're willing to take my payments. If you're willing to take my payments, that means you couldn't accelerate the damn loan, because if you accelerated the loan, then the whole loan is due, and I can't be reinstated back to payments. Acceleration is a process to which you can't go back. No, I want all my money. No payments. I want all my money. Everything else is off the table, because I told you if you didn't do it by September 1st, it was a done deal. So, it matured. I want all my money. But you didn't accelerate it. Yes, I did. You did? Where's the notice? Y'all look in New York, Maynard, and see all them foreclosure and complaints.
The borrower is 18 months behind at a rate of 6.5%, and he's in default.
Oh, he is. Oh, so he's just in default. You agree?
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you made no demands for the unpaid principal balance. You haven't accelerated. Oh, so the contract says that you had to accelerate. Or you may. But if you decided to, that was a separate notice, was it not? You did that? Oh, wow. Oh, man. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry you skipped a step in the process and you put me through all of this. And then you ask for interest and fees, and you're not really entitled to it. And you know what? I don't have to go through a full trial to prove that to you. Let's pull out the note and read it. Matter of fact, let me just humor everybody. Let me find a note right quick. Then I'm going to go to questions. Y'all need to hear this. Let me find a note. Man, you probably got 100 notes around. I know you done read every damn note you've ever seen in your life.
Let me see.
You know, Maynard's like, I don't believe Brother Sharif. He's full of crap. He's such a lie. I'm going to read these notes. And Maynard read them notes, and he had to get a bottle of cognac and be like, I'd be doggone. I'd be darn. All right, I got a note here. All right. And you know, these notes are pretty standard. All right, pretty standard. Most of y'all got notes. You got probably same notes.
Listen to this.
All right. Probably saying notes. So I'm going to read your note to you. Got 90 seconds. You need to call in. You probably need to call in because you need to hear. You need to read your notes. Again, the guru's always telling you to buy something else. Buy something else on top of something else. Get this with an affidavit. Get this audit. Get this title search. Get the title search. Like a debt collector has a title. In 1692, I say you got to go to court if you think you got a title. Right? But let's go and let me read this mortgage. Let me read this note for you. All right? If you go on your note and you look under the default section, okay, which tells you, okay, what's going to happen in default. Notice of default. If I am in default, the note holder may send me a written notice telling me that if I do not pay the overdue amount by a certain date, the note holder may require me to pay immediately the full amount of the principal, which has not been paid, and all the interest that I owe on that amount. The date must be at least 30 days after the date on which the notice is mailed to me or delivered by other means. So in other words, if I don't pay my payments, okay, the creditor has to send me a notice, okay, saying that, look, you got to catch up your payments and give me a date, okay? Or he may require me to pay immediately the full amount. Or if he sends me a notice and saying that I can pay the remaining, the overdue payments, then obviously he hasn't required the full amount, has he? All right? So that means he may. That doesn't mean he did. That don't mean he has to. It's up to his discretion. So he gives me 30 days, okay, after which the date is noticed for me to go around and borrow from my parents and my friends or rob a bank, whatever, and get the back payments. All right? All right? Giving notices. Unless applicable law requires a different method, any notice that must be given, delivered by mailing it by first-class mail. Okay? So, the only provision in your note, in the notice of default, is, look,
I can ask you for the payments and give you a date to pay it. And if you don't pay it, I may ask for the full amount. You have to do both. I mean, you got to do both. You either got to let me pay the payments, or you got to accelerate the loan and inquire that the full amount is due right now. So where is your bill if you got a half a million dollar mortgage? Where is your bill for the $500,000? Where is your acceleration notice saying no payments, payments are off the book? Well, how y'all get modifications if you've been accelerated? How are you going to do foreclosure if you haven't been accelerated? Where is your demand to pay the full amount, unpaid principal amount? Okay? The note holder may require me to pay immediately the full amount of principal, which has not been paid, okay, which has not been paid, and all the interest that I owe on that amount, on that amount. Did it say I can get interest on a default? Is that what it said? Or did it say I can get interest if I demand the full amount, meaning an acceleration? What did y'all hear? Go on, pull out your notes and tell me where it says in there that they can charge you interest and fees on a default. Okay? If the note holder has, okay, let's look at what happens next. Okay, I told you that I may not. If you don't pay me like three payments past due, I love you, brother, and may the forces be with you, but I may have to decide to tell you you have to pay me all the money, and that'll be a lot more difficult for you. But I'm going to give you 30 days, and if you don't do so, then I may just ask for all the money. Or I may not. Okay? Now, what does the note say about payment of note holder's costs and expenses? If the note holder has required me to pay immediately, that means, wow, from the time he said pay me the back due payments, that means something had to happen in between. That means I said, no, you can't pay me the payments anymore. I need all of it. So it says, if the note holder has required me to pay immediately, which is an acceleration, in full, as described above, the note holder will have the right to be paid back by me for all of its costs and expenses in enforcing this note to the extent not prohibited by applicable law. Those expenses include, for example, reasonable attorney fees. But what's the contingency? If they required me to pay immediately, meaning they accelerated it, how are you in court on a default and they're telling you to pay them interest and attorney fees? I'm going to just shut up. Until y'all start reading your own contract and stop listening to these gurus, well, I don't care. Even the courts tell you something different. The law is what? First, the contract, correct? That's the first law. Okay? All right? Let me tell you another little whisper in your ear a little bit more. Some of your state laws prohibit attorney fees and certain fees in foreclosure or debt collector. I bet y'all didn't know that, Ohio. Okay? Got to get serious about it. If you're not going to get serious about it, you're just going to miss it all. Rudy, where you at? Mother, you been...
Rudy had to drop off for a minute.
No, she right here. My line is open.
Oh, is she? I thought she
yes, ma'am.
Had to drop out for a minute.
Are you
yes,
there?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hello?
I'm here.
Okay, no, I'm dropping out now. Remember, 2 o'clock. I'm here, but I'm on my way
out. Okay.
I've been here. I've enjoyed it. Sam has been tremendous. Maynard has been tremendous also. Great call.
All right, Maynard. I know you're getting a bigger office up there. You done pulled that note out. In the bottom of the pile now, because all of y'all done ordered sovereignty packages and UCC liens and title packages and clouded envelopes and securitization audits and motions to make the sky and the moon turn green and all of that. And in the bottom of all that pile was the original contract that you signed that doesn't even say what they say it says. Y'all should be embarrassed. All y'all, take the hammer and hit yourself in the head. All right? First, take the hammer, hit yourself in the head, and then go hit somebody else in the head with it. They're sitting up there lying in front of your face. And they put the documents on there, and they were like, oh, request for judicial notice of the note and the mortgage. And they slapping you with it in your face, and they like, yeah. And you still ain't read it. Put it in a book. You want to hide it? Put it in a book. We know these people are not going to read that contract. They put it right in your face, judicial notice. Be like, judicial notice. Let me highlight the fact that I'm about to cheat you, violate just about every law, including the contract, and I bet you don't even know it. All right. All right,
you know what,
man.
I want to just real quick. And on top of it, you guys, if everybody has, like I'm always saying, get your credit reports at annualcreditreports.com. If you've been disputing your credit report, especially your mortgage, and they're reporting on there after they supposedly re-verify the information that you're in foreclosure, oh, my goodness. 3 from 1681 eyes. That's a good step up there. I mean, how many months? 3 credit reports? 2 people in the household? Oh, my goodness gracious.
Good gosh almighty.
Right?
Good gosh almighty.
Christmas money.
I bet not get one email from anybody telling me anything about a doggone foreclosure that I've been telling y'all for months. Really? Y'all think they can do that? For real? Okay. Right there. Right there in front of your face. They put it right there in their pleadings. By a debt collector. All of them are. All right, let's go to the lines. 209-1019, you're on Thor Radio Network.
Hi, Sharif.
You got a note you just read?
I'm sorry?
You got a note you just read?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Go ahead with your question.
Oh, I was just going to, well, I was asking that Supreme Court case you mentioned some time ago with the audio, where the court was asking them who owns this loan. I'm going to see if you can give me that case so I can find that. I'd like to listen to it.
That was Longin versus Carpenter, and that was the Ibanez case, Ibanez. You can find those on YouTube.
Okay, Ibanez.
Yeah.
U.S. Supreme Court. And I'll send an email. I wanted to ask if I could get a list of the webinars. Those could be purchased after the fact and listened to. Is that true?
Some of them are. Yeah, some of them are. Yeah, you just go to the website. Are you on an email address?
I'm sorry?
Are you on the email address?
Yes, I'm getting emails from you.
Okay. Just request that if you go to the website, on the bottom of the email, you'll see the menu list there on the webinar page.
Okay. Okay, I guess your website is probably in the emails I've been receiving, huh?
Yeah, it's always been on the bottom.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
Man, this was a great call, you guys. Thank you. I've been on.
Thank you.
So have a good day.
You too. I appreciate it. Is Sam still here? He might have dropped off. Let me see. I got to open him back.
He jumped on that train.
Yeah.
All right, Sam, your line back open. All right. Let's go to 910-8308. 8308. My 88 in there. You're on Thor Radio. You mad about your note? 910-8308. I know I'm not like other people where you're falling asleep on Thor now. What's going on?
That's cracking me up. You mad about your note?
Right. 301-9186. You mad about your note?
No, not mad about my note. I actually don't have that provision in my note, but I got another question.
You don't have what provision in your note?
I don't have the provision about them. It says that they may send a notice of acceleration, but it doesn't say that they have to.
So what's different about what I said? That's exactly what I said.
Let me just read the language because I have it here in front of me. It says, lender may choose not to exercise this option without waiving its rights in the event of any subsequent default. So,
okay. You can stop there. What does that mean to you?
I mean, that sounds like they're saying that they don't have to exercise that option without waiving their rights.
So if they don't exercise it, I guess they won't say anything and accept your payments, right? And if they do exercise it, that means they have to let you know, look, I decided to exercise that option, right?
I follow you. I got you.
Okay. That's all. Sometimes I just got to read it back to you because I'm just like, all right, I'm about to hit you in the head with a hammer.
Got you.
It's all the same. There you go.
My question was, I a substitute trustee, I filed a composure complaint. I answered the complaint. I moved for summary judgment. They said too many issues of law, matters of law, so it got denied. Now, they try to move for summary judgment. But one thing I noticed on the note is they're not the holder or the holder in due course, because the note hasn't been endorsed, paid to the order of, or it hasn't been endorsed with a blank endorsement. Now, they have assignment of mortgage on record, but I noticed in the foreclosure complaint that they didn't even mention the note or said that they own the note. And I seen that you referenced the case earlier with Carpenter vs. Logan. So my question is, they're probably going to try to say that they're a non-holder in possession. The Supreme Court case to trump that, right?
Of course. But then you got to understand the holder is no different than a servicer capacity. It's still the boogeyman. Who are you holding it for? Who are you holding it for? How are you going to file a foreclosure? Don't tell me about who you're acting for, but tell me that you're a holder. That means you're not acting for yourself. So you're going to come to and you're going to litigate a case, file a summary judgment, and I don't even know who you are. You haven't identified yourself to the court, and the court's not going to say anything about who you are. Well, wait a minute now. We need to know who you coming in here for. You said you was a holder. Well, court, what are you acting on? What jurisdiction are you acting on when you don't know what jurisdiction you're acting on? Who are they?
Well, that's not
all the time your responsibility. That's their responsibility to know who they give a jurisdiction to. Okay, you can go in there and say, okay, I'm the servicer acting for this particular party. Now all parties are identified. But don't come in and saying you're a holder, but don't tell me who you're holding it for and say, well, the pro se litigant didn't challenge it. No, that's the court's responsibility to maintain jurisdiction or to make sure that they have jurisdiction. The court has a responsibility to make sure everybody appearing before it, that they're acting within their jurisdictional capacity.
So the title trust and the substitution of trustee pursuant to the Trust Indenture Act, blah, 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 when it's a fight.
Again, if it's the holder, who are you holding for? Who are you acting for? You can't come in here as a holder. Two Supreme Court cases say, look, you got to own the note and the mortgage, okay, and a non-mortgagee cannot foreclose. I mean, it just makes sense.
No.
That's a real party in interest. You can come in here if you've been authorized to act, but you got to show me that you've been authorized. If they come in and say, look, we're acting for Wells Fargo, they're the creditor, we're the holder for Wells Fargo, they gave us the authority to come in here and act for them. Okay, that's different. Okay, now you're naming all parties that are involved. But you can't come in here and not say anything about a party and conduct the foreclosure, and I don't know who you are, and you're telling me you're not the holder in due course, you're just a holder.
Well, they haven't even said that. They just said that they just only talk about the assignment of mortgage.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. And the assignment says that they were assigned the mortgage, so let me ask you another question. If they were assigned the mortgage and they're a holder, then the mortgage is over here in Queens and the owner is in Russia? They said that they were assigned the mortgage. Okay, great. That's like being assigned the car with no engine.
Okay, great. Well, where's the engine for the car? Who's running the engine? Who's running the car? So you said you had to sign the mortgage. Well, if you was to sign the mortgage and the note has to, they got to rock together. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have to be down like four flat tires. So what's going on here? What are y'all doing? That's bifurcation. Like, what's the problem here? Who's who? Hey, court, why don't you wake up? Who's sitting here before you? Who's invoked your jurisdiction? Or do you not have any? And it's not my job to determine whether the court has jurisdiction. It's the court's job. Because you issue an order without jurisdiction that may harm me, well, then that's a different problem.
I see.
All right? So you need to attack that. All right? Or you need to get the discovery and be like, all right, who are you? Or you need to tell the court, hey, who are these people? They might be Russian. They might be Al-Qaeda. You know y'all got boogeymen out there. How you know they ain't Al-Qaeda? How you know they ain't holding it for Al-Qaeda or ISIS? Or Putin? Bin Laden, I don't know.
That's
you see?
Yeah.
All right, brother.
All right,
is that all your question is?
I had another question, but I didn't want to take up time.
Go ahead. You got a minute. Go ahead. What do you think?
I had another case in Southern District of New York. I filed seven causes of actions. Now, this was an amended complaint. They filed a motion to dismiss, but I noticed in the motion to dismiss, they didn't address my 1681 S2B claim, the truth in lending claim, or the TCPA claim. But they still moved for dismissal.
You filed it in the state court?
No, I mean no federal court. So Second District, New York.
Uh-huh.
So
you filed in the Eastern, the Western, the Southern, where?
Southern District.
All right.
You know, Pearl Street. Yeah.
All right.
So they didn't like I'm preparing my opposition right now. Opposition to the motion to dismiss. But my thing is, like, one thing they have conceded to my claims, right, typically, right, because they didn't even address them. They didn't even address them in the memorandum of support for the most.
Okay. You're saying they didn't address it in a 12B6?
Yeah, they didn't, like, at all. Like,
okay. That doesn't mean anything. Maybe they thought it was weak and they didn't need to address it and they thought it would be dismissed arbitrarily or... maybe it was strong enough to where they didn't want to touch it. They went after the ones they thought that were going to harm them the most monetarily. You just don't know. You just got to make sure you plead properly and you have proper balance on all your causes of action.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, brother.
All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate
it. All right. Peace, man.
Brother
all
right.
Sharif. Yes, ma'am.
Brother Sharif. I just have a question. I was just listening to this caller, and when he asked his first question, and he was talking about the endorsements on the note, and I know that we may look at the endorsements on the note, but I was wanting to question the fact that it appears to me that he might be potentially pleading some subject matter versus just sticking with the FDCPA, and I just wanted to question that. And making sure that there's not a lot of emphasis on, and I just heard him in the second question talking about several causes of action. He talked about the TILA and the potential possibility of confusing some things when we're looking at an FDCPA case.
Yeah, I don't, TILA is food money. I mean, to litigate a TILA action, the most you're going to get is probably enough money to file your federal case. You get a couple thousand dollars on TILA. I mean, and then who is TILA for? Who is TILA for? Creditors.
That'd be a
right?
creditor.
Right. So why are you suing a debt collector saying, you violated the creditor-related law? Again, look, let me tell you something. If I pay $10,000 for a $100,000 debt and I'm able to trick you into thinking I'm a creditor and you go as far as to go ahead and sue me for $2,000 because I don't know what the hell I'm doing as a creditor because I'm a damn debt collector and you sue me under creditor law saying that I violated one of the creditor laws, I will pay you $2,000. That's just $12,000 and I still
got $88,000 left to bust you upside your head, plus fees and charges and interest and all that. I'm going to let you win that. I'm going to settle with you.
All right, well, look, I'm going to pay you this money. I'm going to have you sign a stipulation that I'm the creditor now, and I should never do that again.
Right.
You know I'm your damn creditor, and you know you can sue me again under the truth in lending. Uh-huh. All right. Y'all get it? Yeah.
Yeah. See, so, that, you know, the consumer protection laws are what we're talking about. And, you know, so I hear that. And I understand it's a little bit difficult. Maybe we think we get it, but then sometimes we just don't, because we need to come out of that lane of dealing with subject matter. This is not about subject matter. This is about debt collection and how we're being treated under the consumer protection laws. That's what we just read in that last case. So when I hear, you know, endorsements on the notes or TILA or anything pertaining to the mortgage, the foreclosure, and anything that's dealing with the creditor, that is not what we're talking about. And we have to understand who we are. That's what we talked about. Who are you? Who are we? Who are they? That we have to get that straight first before we even start dealing in this arena.
Right. Can't call you a monkey and a zebra at the same time. All right, let's go to 412-1568.
Hey, Brother Shereen, how you doing today?
Radio, a.k.a. Trendsetter. What's happening?
I'm just saying, how you doing today, man?
I'm good, brother.
I got to praise you before I get my question out there. I got to praise you now. I don't know if you're tired of hearing people praise you, but I got to praise you.
Nah, man, it's just blessings, man. It's not me. You're praising the creator. I couldn't do none of this by myself, so I appreciate you.
Okay, well, you the medium that he's working through. And I don't know why he chose you, because there's some people perpetrating, trying to do what you're doing. what I'm saying is that you have the best webinars, okay? A lot of people have webinars where they tell you things, but they have no paperwork. A webinar is pointless if you don't have the paperwork, because a person, if they got to make their own, they need some type of template or some type of form to structure their own lawsuit or their arguments or their debt validation or verification letters. You give them that. You got the best webinars out of everybody. So, you know, I put
it
out there. You know,
I know you've been around, so I take that serious, because I know you've been around.
Yeah, because you're the best at the webinars. And like I said, the people on the public side and the private side, you're on the public. And I tell everybody that you have the best webinars. You get way more than what you're paying for. And when you get done, you're like, wow, man, you know, I got way more than what I paid for. So that's how you feel once you get, you know, some of your products. I had to tell you that, you know.
Appreciate it.
And I let it be known. I let it be known you got the best webinars. Now, the question I wanted to ask you, you were on here, I think maybe about 3 weeks ago, and you were saying something to the effect that Ocwen is, court decided said that they're a debt buyer. And you stated a case. You said a case, didn't you? I don't know if you remember.
Lori, you remember that case? Oh, God. You sent it to me, didn't you?
Which one was it again? I'm sorry?
It was the one where Ocwen, the judge kind of Thor hammered him in the head and was like, look, you're not a servicer. You purchased the debt. I can remember where I seen it on my computer, but I believe you sent it to me. You remember which one it was? Brother, email me. I will find it for you, because it was one of a kind.
Yeah, you know what,
about
too,
a month ago.
I had it on an envelope, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. I wrote on an envelope, and I can't find an envelope. So I had to
do it. Yeah, I'll find it now. I mean, yeah, email me, and I'll get it to
email you. What do I email you up under?
Yeah, debtshow@yahoo.com.
Okay, then I'll email you that. And the next question I wanted to ask you was, you speak of the promissory note, and the sister was saying that a lot of this stuff deals with mortgagers. I mean, you speak of the promissory note, that goes to like creditors. But what I'm seeing from what you're teaching is that can be used as false and misleading statements when you're masquerading as a creditor, and all these notes, the mortgage, that's all prima facie evidence of you masquerading, being something that you're not. So, you know, that's why, you know, I ask questions about that. But I wanted to ask you, the note, is it or is it not a non-negotiable instrument?
You know, I mean, I'll be honest with you. You can flip-flop between Article 3 and Article 9. I don't think it's a non-negotiable instrument, okay? I'm reading it. I mean, I read both of them all the time. Most of the courts are trying to keep it under Article 3. I really think it falls under Article 9, clear and plain. But since really the UCC arguments really don't gain a lot of traction, and you're not going to get paid off of it, it's a commercial Bible. So you can use it as dressing, you know, for other things that you may have to say. You don't need to use it in your consumer protection case at all. The FDCPA by itself is enough. You don't have to add no dressing to that. That is good by itself. So I'm going to be honest with you. Most of the attorneys out there, they don't really want to mess with the UCC. They just really
yes,
don't. You can file a case and you can file a pleading, and you start going all UCC on them, and they'll be like, look, man, we the holder, and the note says, and they're going to run. And the courts are really not going to put a whole lot of emphasis in it unless it's used to support their decision, whether it's for you or against you. They might throw a little bit of Article 3, Article 9, and whatnot in there. I say use everything you have, man, but don't depend on it. Give a little bit of this, give a little bit of that. Just make sure you go in there and be like, no, I don't think it's under Article 3. I actually think it's non-negotiable under Article 9, you know, and bearer paper, things of that nature.
Well, that's what I believe. When I'm putting this out there, that's just a jab. The jab is just, you know, setting up the right hand. Because with that being the case, the if it's a non-negotiable instrument, and then the fact that they put a rider to it, they negotiated it. And from my understanding, and I could be right, I could be wrong, but they're not supposed to put a rider along with it if it's non-negotiable. So, you know, that's what
and there's other things about that note that makes it, you know, under Article 9 clearly, but this is what you got to understand. They're not going to give you a silver bullet to just shoot them all down. They're going to be like, look, you're going to have to use something else. In addition to that, to have us knock out that debt. And, you know, I mean, I hate to say this, but sometimes the law has nothing to do with it. It's what you can prove. And, again, if you're arguing the Uniform Commercial Code, who is that for? You see what I mean?
I thought it was for commercial courts. I thought that since you're in a commercial court, the UCC did apply since it's a commercial court.
It's for creditors.
No, I'm saying
even if you look at
it
from the perspective, even if you look at it from the perspective of a lot of the sovereign stuff that's going on, a lot of the private stuff that's going on, what are you filing those things in there for? Because you're a creditor. Okay, so those are for creditors. So, again, you arguing with a debt collector about the UCC, is that the proper argument? Well, no. Would a creditor, would a National Banking Association or a creditor? Yeah, that's the proper argument. So, again, you see, so I don't need to go there, bro. I'm not talking to a damn creditor, man. I'm talking to a monkey, so I'm going to give you a banana. I'm not talking to somebody other than a debt collector. So the UCC don't even matter. But, listen, you was trying to enforce this note right here, right, that you say is my note, and I'm not going to argue that right now. But let's look at the note, man. Let's see if really, because, you know, I think you're a fake. You don't move to me like a monkey. And I'm going to tell you why you ain't a monkey. If you look at that note don't even say what you're saying. See, a creditor would know that. But since you're not a creditor, you're trying to pull everything you can because, really, you're just a third-party debt buyer and debt collector. And you're acting like one because debt collectors really don't know how to act like creditors. You see how you just humiliate them like that? Okay, right. You have your hearing on your motion to dismiss and you have everything. He's like, okay, so I'm looking at your complaint and you say that you can do this, that, and the third. Can you point out to me, because you did attach a copy of the alleged note that's there, and I specifically deny that that's even an obligation or note that I executed. But regardless of that, let's just read it, okay, just for the sense of humor. Let's just read it and see. Now, you said over here in your complaint that you can do that. Can you point me the section out in the note that supports that? and then just stay there. What else? What else are they going to say? You see what I mean?
Well, reason why I was saying that, because I always just look for different, because I'm getting real close to where I have to have, you know, my days in court. So I'm starting nailing everything down. But I'm basically seeing that all this stuff that they're perpetrating are all separate causes of action under the consumer protection laws. You know, you're saying that, hey, you know, you have the note and you this and you that. You're saying you're a creditor when you're a debt collector. So all those are different separate causes of actions. It's basically, I'm looking to get paid, you know, on these actions that they're doing. I'm looking at,
then I believe you on that. I believe you on that, brother. That's why I know that you want to go in there and you want to go in there like the Matrix and throw like 18 stars at them on both sides. And I'm saying, nah, just go in there and humor them a little bit. Be like, okay, so you're a creditor, right? Let me look at your complaint. Let me look at this note that you said you got up there that I signed. Let's take a look at that. And let's see if even what you're saying is true. And after you really dismantle them there, then you can be like, you know what, I'm tired of playing with you over there because over here doesn't get me paid. So I'm going to walk across the street, get this little FDCPA case going on because everything in your complaint can be used against you in the FDCPA case. So you put in there that you would do interest? Nah, that's not true. You put in there that I was, no, that's not true. You put in there that I was in default. Well, if I was in default, I mean, the note says there's a couple of other steps after that you must take before you're even here. So that means you're here, and really, court doesn't have jurisdiction. You know, you see how many ways you can play with them. But, again, over there doesn't get me paid, across the street does. So I know you're trying to get over there and trying. You're not going to beat them at that game. Okay? You're just not.
No, you want to get paid. But you're thinking you basically want to get paid. Yeah, because sometimes
be gullible, be unsophisticated, be the least sophisticated, be trusting, okay, and be naive. And I know that's hard for you to be, but you gotta do it. You gotta
play the game. I know, because basically you're setting them up for this over here. Because before, when I said it many times before on the show, like you have so many violations that's going to exceed the value of that home you're trying to keep. You can probably buy 10 of those homes from the causes of action that the debt collectors are doing. So I'm looking way past it, like, you know, like I heard you were saying before, stopping them is nothing. You want to get paid. So my thing is I'm just lining up various causes of actions because that's how cases are, you know, won on pleading and proving causes of action. Because life, they don't have they really can't plead and prove their causes of action. So that's why most of the time when I come in here, I'll ask these questions. But the very last question would be, I can't get an answer on this. Maybe you can give me an answer. Are those notes notarized? Because sometimes, you know,
that's another thing. Some of them are not. Some of them are absolutely not notarized. So what? It's not. And for the rules of evidence, they're going to say, well, it's authenticated because it's notarized. But then, okay, well, then you can make an argument to that as well. But then you're going to say it's not even notarized? Man, that probably came out your briefcase. What are you talking about?
Well, the reason why I'm asking that question is if they're notarized at closing and then after closing you see all these attached signatures, you can't sign something after it's been notarized. So that's what I'm trying to figure out. Are they notarized or supposed to be notarized? I don't know what exactly is the rule. Like at closing, do they notarize those notes?
Of course.
Are they notarizing them?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
Layla,
I got
you're in the mortgage business. Do they notarize or no?
Yeah, no, in our state, there are not. I've not seen any state. I've dealt in three or four different states, and I've never seen the note notarized.
What? I've seen a thousand of them.
I haven't seen any notes. Not notes. That now the mortgage or the deed of trust, yes. But the note, no.
Okay, because
well,
I've heard they're supposed to be.
Well, you know what? Wait a minute. I might be mistaken because you know what? I was talking about the note. But I got notes notarized.
Okay.
It says right there on the bottom. It says right there, to witness the hands and seals of the undersigned. And, yeah, when you seal something, it'll be notarized.
Okay,
because you have to understand the note is the most important part of that transaction. The mortgage don't mean crap. Mortgage is just a memorialization of what's going on. And the note is the money. Okay? The note is the money.
But most notes are copies.
I would think that would be notarized. Go ahead.
Yeah.
But most of them, when you get a note at closing, you get all your documents. They're unsigned. They're blank. You know what I'm saying? So the note you have is not the note because all the paperwork you have, they're unsigned. Because I've gotten many of like mortgages and stuff, and I've seen them. They're unsigned. You don't even have your signature. They just give you blank copies of everything. But the reason why I'm asking that question, there's a brother by the name of Brett Jones, and he was saying that these notes are supposed to be notarized. And if they're notarized at closing, you can't sign any notarized document after the fact. You're not supposed to.
Well, so, I would think they should be notarized, but also, I mean, I'm not going to say I've done transactions where they were notarized right there in front of me. Okay, so, I mean, they notarize your signature. They bring a notary in and when you sign it. So they're not blank. They're blank until you sign it, and then many times they'll bring the notary in, but then many times it's notarized after you leave.
Okay.
So, again, your challenge is then what's your reply? That note wasn't notarized when I left that closing office. And who's the only witness? Who's the eyewitness to that? You and who?
Yep.
The notary,
yep.
Right? They're going to bring the notary
in? The closing agent. The closing agent.
They're
going to
bring the closing agent in? Yeah. Good luck finding them. They'd be like that mob witness that witnessed Guido chop the head off of Jack Soliano. Okay, you think you're going to find that witness? No, you're not. Okay.
What's the sister's name?
I have the narrative that I just pulled dated December of 2012. Because my note that I have for my mortgage transaction is dated in 2001. So I looked at it. It doesn't have an area for a notary. This note is dated December 2012, and the institution is a major institution. And there is no place for a notary on this note. That's here in the state of Texas. So I just wanted to impart that. So that's a very
okay, Layla, you was in mortgage. What did you remember notarizing?
The only thing that was notarized was the deed of trust. And then there's some ancillary documents. I'm looking at this package. This is the closing package I'm looking at here. And they had some sort of a soft second on the property, and that is notarized, but not the note. The deed of trust is.
Hmm. Well, I gotta go back and look. Sure. Go ahead.
Let me ask Ms. Layla a question if I can. Now,
yes.
Are you familiar with the abstract of title papers, where it's basically saying that the borrower is really the creditor? Is that all myth? Or is that true?
Is
it an abstract title saying that the borrower is the
creditor? You're going deep there again.
Am I going to see
abstract
right?
And all that? You get in that district court, they're going to take your damages away. They're like, boy, you're too smart, but ain't nobody fool you. You don't have no actual damages. You're too smart. You've been reading all that stuff. You're talking about abstract. Now we don't think you suffered any harm, and we're just going to give you the $1,000 and let you go on home, okay? I'm going to be honest with you.
I don't know the answer to that question, you know. And I remember when I look at the title, all I wanted to know was make sure that I had the right mortgagee name. I wanted to make sure the amount was right. I wanted to make sure there were no liens or no federal liens or no judgments against them. So I'm going to have to inquire to be able to answer your question. We can probably get back to you during the next.
That's cool. What I'm going to do is I'm going to email Debt Show, and I'll put the question in there. And as far as the Aquin being a debt buyer, that case, I'd definitely like to get that. And Sharice, I don't know. I'm gonna have to pay you for some consultation. So donate. I'm gonna have to make a donation for some consultation. So I'm gonna put that in my.
I'm gonna have to bring the hammer to. I'm gonna have to hit you in the head because you not being gullible and naive and trusting. Trust what I say, brother.
That's what I say.
You don't know anything. You're just like I'm confused. I am so confused. I've had so much anxiety. I don't look at my wife the same way anymore. She doesn't look at me the same way anymore. My favorite meal is spaghetti. She hasn't cooked for me because I've been worried that these debt collectors are going to take my home, and I am just – I just don't know what to do right now.
All right. Well, I'm going to hit you up on a debt show, and we'll get together and talk. All right. Hey, thank you, Layla. I appreciate it, okay? All right.
Hey, real quick, that case is Zervos versus Aquin.
Zervos versus, okay, I got that one right.
Yeah.
Hold it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Zervos, Z-E-R-V-O-S,
O-S.
Versus Oakley. That is exactly. See,
that's
I tell
it.
You, boy, I got the best team on the market.
That's it.
All right. Let's go to 443-1257.
Hi, my question is, you touched on, what was it, the awarded possession, those who are facing eviction. What pleading, or how could you write your pleading? Because you said it's the lien that's been sold according to A5, the debt. But how can you plead that if you're facing the possession part now without the opposing party bringing in the res judicata piece?
There is no res judicata. You're not arguing the foreclosure. You're arguing the consumer protection law. So you never argued that. Did you ever file a FDCPA case? Was one filed against you? One couldn't have been filed against you because you're a consumer. So there's no res judicata. Don't confuse the two. Foreclosure and debt collection, although they can be used, okay, in some way synonymous, well, it's a debt collection action once it crosses the street into the FDCPA. It's alleged to be a foreclosure action for purposes of state court. There's no res judicata. I'm saying that
okay.
you violated the consumer, the federal consumer protection law.
Okay, so if the individual is facing the eviction, post-sale and everything, and they can bring up an opposition to the possession based on the FDCPA?
No. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
That's what I'm saying.
Those courts don't have jurisdiction over that. You got to file your case, all right, and you have to deal with the eviction. The eviction, that court is going to presume that it has jurisdiction because they're saying you're a tenant. So you have that. Those are two separate things. Don't confuse them. One is not going to stop the other. So if you have a landlord coming after you and he's a purchaser, bona fide purchaser for value, he bought a debt and he's attempting to collect on that debt by getting the property from you. So he may, in some cases, be considered a debt collector. Especially if he bought it from a debt collector. So no, it's different than, you know, debt buyers buying this debt. All right, I'm going to sell it to you, Billy Bob, and here it is. And you don't have any more authority than the debt collector that sold it to him.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, that's what we wanted to know. Thank you.
You got to deal with that eviction from another standpoint. And, you know, with the eviction is just, you know, only thing that addressed that is a quiet title or, you know, that's the only thing. You got to make it an issue of title. So really, you know. It's tricky.
Right. Okay.
What state is she in, and how much time does she have?
If you file the FDCPA case before the eviction, you know, it may get them to think twice. Okay? It may. I'm not guaranteeing you that. It may. But you gotta deal with both.
Right.
You can go to
okay.
set it aside.
Right.
You can find reason to set the foreclosure aside. Based on evidence I just told you, based on the note, based on the interest
mm-hmm.
that was charged, based on the lack of acceleration, based on the maturity. I mean, all of those things, you can go back. That's evidence that you can set it aside. You need to make an attempt to do so and get them to stay the eviction until the court makes a determination on that.
Okay.
All right?
Okay. All right. We'll do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're out of time. We thank everybody for being here today. Thank my team. Thank Sam for coming in and participating. You'll see a little bit more of him. Rudy, Layla, and Lori, I thank all of you. We will see you on Friday. Friday, we're doing American Violence, Part 5. Child abuse. What is it and what isn't? What isn't it, for lack of a better word? We're going to deal with that issue. We're going to see what's law, what's not. We hope that you all come and participate in that event on Friday at 11 a.m. on Thor Radio Network. We are a family network, so we're going to deal with family things. We can deal with debt, but if they're taking our kids and telling us we can't discipline our kids or what discipline is, then we can have all the debt or lack of debt that we want, we're still not going to be happy and secure in our person. So join us Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We hope you got something out of our show today. Again, I thank my team. Thank Sam. Thank all the callers. Thank all the participants and supporters of Thor. Keep supporting us. Peace and blessings. May the Creator be with you.
Hey, hey.